October 14th, 2020. This is a morning meeting of the Portland City Council. Keelan, can you please call the roll?
Good morning. Hugh Daly.
Here.
Fritz. Ryan.
Here.
Hardesty.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. And is Commissioner Fritz excused today, Keelan? I don't remember.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Interesting. So legal counsel, I'm going to have you figure something out and we'll get to the agenda in just a moment. I'm going to have to recuse myself from an item late in the agenda. In fact, it's the last agenda item. Ordinarily, I would turn that over to the council president. Lindley, who will I turn it over to instead?
It is my understanding that Commissioner Fritz was intending to attend beginning at 10:45 through noon. Okay. And Keelan, can you confirm that, please?
That is correct. She'll be here from 10:45 to noon.
Okay. And just for my edification and everybody else's, how would we do it if the council president isn't present? Does it go back to the prior council president, or what would be the ordinary procedure?
I will look that up. I think you are correct, but I'd have to look it up.
All right. It's just one of those curiosities. All right. Please note, City Hall is closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the council are attending remotely by video and teleconference, and the city's made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting's available to the public on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps, of course, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all again for your patience, your flexibility, and your understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. With that, we'll turn it over to Lindley for the rules of order and decorum. Good morning.
All right. Good morning. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first meetings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you're a lobbyist. If you're representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Thank you. First up is communications. Lindley, 807, please. I mean, I'm sorry, Lindley. Keelan, 807, please.
Okay, 807, request of Matt Smith to address council regarding the practice of Portland police sharing mugshots and personal information of protesters accused of nonviolent crimes. Let's see, I don't know if Matt is signed on this morning. I don't see him yet.
Okay, well, if he pops up, I want to hear what he has to say. 808,
request of Susan Cotter to address council regarding Portland City Council communications plan.
Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, can you?
We did for a second. It sounds like you remuted. Could you check your mute, please?
Susan wanted to show slides, so I have promoted her to a panelist. She should be able to unmute shortly.
Susan, are you there? We still can't hear you.
Yeah, there we go. Can you hear me now? Yes.
Yay. Great. Good morning.
Good morning. Now I'm going to see, can you see this screen?
Yep, we sure can.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners Udaly, Hardesty, and Ryan for this opportunity to speak to you. My name is Susan Cotter. I use she, her pronouns. I live in North Portland and am an unaffiliated community member. I once spoke to City Council about the difficulty I had in trying to assess the state of police oversight and asking you to show your work. Then another occasion asking Council to find compassion and protect our community members against PPD's use of force. I was going to discuss the need for a city communication plan, but Commissioner Hardesty's great work on Rethink Portland and the Western States training has prompted me to change my topic for this morning to share my take on community safety. This is what we have said is public safety in a democracy. Oh, having a hard time moving my screen here. Hang on, there we go, oops.
There you go.
But we are nearly unanimous that the system isn't working. And we now know if all goes right, we are on track for police reform in 18 to 24 months, to which I say, yikes. Our Western States training taught us we need community members prepared to respond to unsafe behaviors, no matter the source. Maybe it looks more like a combination of under control law enforcement and community prepared to effectively participate in the safety of everyone. The city is uniquely qualified to formalize a network of community responses to safety while ensuring adherence to community equity standards. I think we have hit a critical mass of people fed up with the white male anti-democratic system that works for fewer and fewer. It gives us an opportunity to channel immediate responses, collectively manage and improve guidelines, and build common cause and competencies for all Portlanders around safety. I ask Council to develop a network to encompass all safety support systems to help the community take back control of our safety. Fund this effort today. Thanks for your consideration. Black Lives Matter. With no justice, there is no peace.
Thank you. I appreciate that thoughtful, that's a thoughtful presentation. I appreciate it. And there's a lot of good stuff there. Thanks for bringing that, Susan.
Thank you.
Next up is 809, please. I'm sorry, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I guess you didn't see my little hand, my little blue hand.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
It's all good.
I like your new lamp, by the way. It's awesome.
Thank you. It's the old lamp. I just turned my computer a different way. I got tired of the view.
And so, it's a nice upgrade. It looks good.
Thank you. Susan, I would love to have your presentation and have a chance to talk to you about your words this morning. It was a very efficient and thorough presentation. Good job. People don't normally get it that good in the 3 minutes that they have. And you had time to spare. So if you would be kind enough to share your PowerPoint and reach out to my office so that we can schedule some time to talk, because it sounds like there's a lot of us that are moving in the same direction, and you framed it beautifully. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for all your support. I think your Rethink Portland is amazing, well thought out, well strategized, and I really appreciate your effort.
Thank you. Back at you, Susan. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you, Susan. Next up is 809, please.
Mayor, it looks like 807 Matt Smith has signed on. Do you want to have him speak?
Let's go back to Mr. Smith. That'd be great. Matt. Hi, Matt.
Okay, let me right.
Keelan, is he unmuted?
It looks like, Matt, are you able to unmute? There we go. It looks like he is unmuted.
Matt, can you, for whatever reason, we're still not hearing him. Is he on a computer or on a phone?
Looks like he's on a computer.
Check your volume.
Oh, and he's also on the phone.
Maybe we can just get really him quick. On the phone line.
Okay, Matt, are you able to unmute now?
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yep, there you go. Good, we've got you.
Great, thank you. Thank you for your time today. I just wanted to talk about the practice of publicizing photographs of people that are being booked as a result of arrests in Portland at the Multnomah County Detention Center. You know, as you know, there have been a lot of arrests lately around the protests. And just observing this process, you know, it seems a little incoherent with respect to not only the presumption of innocence, but also the efforts that we're making to address implicit bias in policing and promote racial justice. You know, the fundamental dissonance I have with it, I suppose, is that you know, when people are arrested, it's an allegation of a crime being committed. And, you know, at that stage, everyone gets their picture in the paper. And, you know, so there's the amplification of the arrest process, which is let's take everyone's picture, let's promote it on social media, on the website. And then beyond that, you know, we know that there's implicit bias in policing where, you know, Black protesters are twice as likely to get arrested as white protesters, you know, people are more likely to get pulled over than white people. And the publicizing of those photographs, you know, tends to reinforce racial stereotypes. So we're basically putting an amplifier on the input of our criminal justice system that everyone admits is flawed. And it seems to be something that is just going to perpetuate racial stereotypes rather than help to focus on the output of the criminal justice system, which, you know, hopefully things are more just on the backside of it than on the front side of it. I know that San Francisco, back in June, I think, primarily because of implicit bias, decided to no longer publish photographs for bookings unless the crimes were, you know, pretty serious in terms of violent crimes. You know, certainly not for interfering with a peace officer, which, you know, in Multnomah County, as you know, the district attorney isn't even bringing charges for in the first place. So I just wanted to bring that to the council's attention, you know, and ask the question, is this practice aligned with, you know, these efforts that we have going on right now? And, you know, is it, you know, fundamentally, is it aligned with the, you know, principle of, you know, presumption of innocence? I certainly don't see photographs being published when the charges are dropped, you know? So I just wanted to bring that, you know, to the council's attention, point towards the fact that it, you know, is not exactly aligned with racial justice initiatives, and ask that, you know, we consider the practice.
That's 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Perfectly timed, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mr. Smith. I share your concern about presumptive guilt when people are arrested at protests, and hope that you will provide us your, was your testimony in writing? Or were you just talking off the cuff? Mr. Smith, are you muted again?
Keelan, is he still on?
I'm unmuted now. Sorry about that. Yeah, that was just off the cuff, but I can certainly, you know, put together those thoughts and submit written testimony on this topic.
I would appreciate it if you would do that, because I share your concern. We should, just like we don't publish police officers' names when they are accused of bad acts, we certainly should not be putting that information on a city-owned website. And the mayor and I have had many conversations about the communication style of the police bureau's PIO officers. And I think that you are providing us with some valuable information that will inform how we move forward. So thank you very much. And yes, please send us an email so that I can follow up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Matt, thank you for the testimony. I think you raised some entirely valid points. One cautionary note, just I know where some of the pushback will come from. It will come from the press that will say they have a right to this information. There's often a healthy dynamic tension between the police bureau's provision of information and the needs and the expectations of the free press in terms of publishing information. But I think it's an entirely valid conversation, and it's one we absolutely should have. And it's one we should have both internally as well as with PPB. And I think there also has to be an open dialogue with members of the local media to get their perspectives and thoughts on this as well. But your basic point, I think, is a really good one, which is the presumption of innocence, particularly when we're talking about, you know, what is effectively lower level criminal activity.
Thank you, Mayor. I think that the point that was being made, and maybe Mr. Smith, I didn't hear your point correctly. I didn't hear anything about the media's right to do whatever the media has an obligation to do. I think what Mr. Smith is talking about is how we use city media tools to put information out in the street when we don't have all the facts at the time that we put it out.
No dispute about that whatsoever. I'm just saying that when we have information internally that we've already collected, the media often asks for that information, and they often have a precedent for getting that information. So I'm just saying it's a broader conversation than merely the question of which information we collect and put out. There's a larger dynamic tension between PPB and the press, where they are regularly asking and saying they have a legal right to additional information that we may or may not be prepared to share. I'm just saying it's another dynamic we have to be aware of as a city council.
I am looking forward to that conversation, Mayor, because I think the media has the right to ask for information, but we also have an obligation not to be criminalizing people just because they've been arrested.
No disagreement, and we're unfortunately getting into the conversation that we agreed
on. That we're not going to have.
Let's continue with this council session and put that in the parking lot along with the other 150 issues.
If I could make one final point. What I'm putting, trying to put my finger on is the photograph itself, not the arrest record. You know, there's no problem with publishing that, you know, someone's name, where they live, whatever. But I don't think we should, you know, say, oh, and they're black, you know, like the photograph is perpetuating the racial stereotype. And it's also, potentially allowing the targeted harassment of someone identifying by their face, which is a different ballgame than having the mere arrest record available to the media.
Yeah, that's a very legitimate and important point. I appreciate you making it. Thank you.
I think we need to bring Mr. Smith into that conversation too.
Absolutely. All right, thank you, sir. We'll move on now, 809.
Request of Elijah Cetus to address council regarding proposed drone testing facility in St. John's on North Bradford Street.
Hey there, can you all hear me? Can you hear me okay? Good morning, commissioners. My name is Elijah Cetus. I'm an organizer of the group called Just Climate and a founding member of the Braided River Campaign, which is a new coalition of residents and advocates working to advance a community vision for a climate resilient working waterfront in the Portland Harbor. I'm here today to comment in opposition to a proposed development by Skyward, which is a drone manufacturer and subsidiary of Verizon Wireless, proposing a 5G drone testing facility in the St. John's neighborhood along the river and adjacent to Cathedral Park. The site on North Bradford is one of the few remaining open industrial lands on the river, and it holds enormous potential for community use, for clean energy and climate resilient projects, for ecological restoration, and for blue collar job creation. In other words, for the kinds of projects that our city is committed to support as part of its overall climate justice priorities. Skyward is proposing to fly its drones over the river and is claiming they're a river-dependent industry and require the site because, quote unquote, drone testing over public roadways, parks, or similarly congested areas are not suitable due to potential safety issues. This is untrue that the site is empty. The site neighbors one of the busiest stretches of river for recreation and community activities. Every week, there's hundreds of boats, kayaks, canoes. Indigenous residents hold water ceremonies at Cathedral Park. Unhoused and housed residents live along its shores and in the neighborhoods. And peregrine falcons, eagles, and osprey make their nests beneath the bridge. Over this stretch of public water, Skyward is proposing to test commercial drones that exceed 55 pounds in weight and would create enormous noise pollution, infringe on neighborhood privacy, and recklessly endanger wildlife and community members. Drone technology is not neutral. The implications of 5G drone testing for surveillance, militarization, and the automation of good-paying industrial jobs needs to be considered by this council, just as this council considered and then rejected facial recognition technology this year. On its website and in public statements, Skyward celebrates pushing past regulations and laws governing its industry. They advertise drone technology with thermal heat visualization, drones that eliminate human elements, quote unquote, and drones that will one day fly on their own throughout our nation's airspace. Residents were not made aware of this project until shortly before the public comment period ended last month. But despite this, numerous comments were submitted. Cathedral Park Neighborhood Association wrote a letter in opposition, and more than 400 people have now signed a petition saying no. I just want to remind you that North Portlanders are disproportionately burdened by environmental injustices. The exposure to some of the worst air quality in the nation, higher rates of asthma and infant mortality, as well as proximity to the Portland Harbor Superfund site, which is one of the most toxic places in the nation. They also live in the catastrophic blast zone of oil trains and tank farms housed along the river, as well as the liquefaction zone, which would be cataclysmic if the earthquake hit. So I just want to urge you to oppose this project. The working class neighborhood of St. John's is not the place for a drone testing site. And I urge you to oppose this project with a letter to the Port of Portland, which is the property owner, and to direct your bureaus to deny the permits that they've requested, starting with an open permit application to widen and develop the Bradford Street Road. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. That was good insight. Thank you. Next individual is 810, please.
Request of Barbara Quinn to address council regarding proposed drone testing facility in St. John's.
Commissioner Hardesty, do you have your hand raised or is that old?
Oh, no, sorry, Mayor, is old.
Okay, no worries. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, thank you. Thank you for letting me testify. I'm actually testifying about exactly the same issue that Elijah just mentioned. It's in reference to Land Use Review LU20-142770 GW. The proposal for a drone test site on the Willamette Riverfront, just north of Cathedral Park. What I'd like to add to his testimony, I agree with everything he said. The test flight pattern is going to be north on the river for an unknown distance. They didn't really define the boundaries. And Verizon says they will not be flying over public spaces, but it ignores the fact that the river is in fact a public space. And it's also true that the Federal Aviation Administration has no federal restrictions on overflight of residential areas. That means that we only have Verizon's word that they won't fly over neighborhoods, even though there's absolutely nothing legal that would stop them. So there is concerning potential for privacy violations, especially since Verizon does not have a good track record in the area of privacy protection. The company handed over private information of its entire customer base in response to an arguably illegal request from the NSA. So I agree with Elijah that our diverse North Portland community has already been burdened with too many things, and we do not need the fear of overhead surveillance or the danger of the possibility that these test drones could actually go down. They do have a boat that's going to retrieve the drones, so that means that there's a possibility that they can go down in the river, I think. So that doesn't sound like a very safe situation. The other problem is it really appropriate for a public agency such as the Port of Portland to impose and compel us to house, to host this business when the largest market for these drones has always been government, military, and law enforcement around the world? You know, we're not comfortable with the type of business it is. And unfortunately, our privacy laws are not strong enough to ensure that this new technology will be used responsibly. So for those reasons, until privacy law can catch up with technology, this proposal should be off the table and not imposed on the community by a public agency such as the Port of Portland with no meaningful public process or input. And so I agree with Elijah that this should be not supported by the council and should be refused, and that is true of the Port of Portland as well. This is not a good fit for our community.
Thank you, Barbara. Commissioner Udaly has her hand raised. Commissioner Udaly,
good morning. Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to thank the last two testifiers. This issue, I vaguely recollect hearing about it, but I really appreciate the details you're bringing. I know Braided River Campaign has a Facebook page, but can you direct us, either submit written information or direct us to a website where we could learn more? I mean, I can...
Sorry about that.
Time to get up.
Sorry about that.
Flashback to growing up on a farm.
That was awesome.
That was
the best cameo appearance so far today.
I'm sorry. So I can certainly look into the permits, because one of those permits, it sounds like, is coming from PBOT for the road widening. But anywhere I could learn more information about this proposal. And all the listeners today.
I can send some written testimony.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I was curious. You said that where is this being decided? Did you say that the port was moving this forward? And does that mean it then comes to the city council? I'm not sure what the governmental processes as this process moves forward. Do you know? Barbara?
Well, my understanding is it's a land use review. The public comment period's already over. The project, according to development services, it's on hold at the moment. And the port is just going to say yes or no to the lease. They're leasing it out. So I don't know exactly what kind of input the council has there, but it's the city of Portland is reviewing the request.
For the permitting.
If I could jump yes. in, I'm gonna guess, yes. and I'm just, this is an educated guess, and maybe there's staffers or legal on the line who know better, but I'm gonna guess the land use piece is in the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. The permit piece is in the Bureau of Development Services. And it sounds like just by virtue of the road work, PBOT's gonna be involved in that as well. But it sounds like it may largely be administrative at the Bureau level.
Well, I'll check in with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I suspect Commissioner Udaly will be checking in with her bureaus.
Yeah. And Dan's got BDS.
So it sounds like we're going to be having individual conversations soon about how this all comes together and what our roles should be. Thank you so much.
I would just also like to add that I, like Elijah, I appreciate that the City Council passed an ordinance about facial recognitions. That's very forward thinking and commendable.
Thank you very much. Once in a while, we can actually look into the future and do something that's really innovative. So I am very proud that we did that collectively, unanimously. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you. Keelan, does that complete communications for today?
Yes, right. That completes.
Have any items been pulled off of our consent agenda?
We've had no requests.
Please call the roll.
Udaly.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The consent agenda is adopted. We'll move to time certain. Yep, we're on time. Time certain 8:11, please.
Accept 2019 e-scooter findings report and authorize next steps regarding a solicitation from shared micro-mobility providers to operate in a permanent program.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Oh, just lost my screen. One moment.
And while we're at it, Commissioners Udaly and Hardesty, your hands are still raised. If you could lower them at your
feet. Oh. Sorry. All right. Colleagues, today we have a presentation from PBOT about e-scooters. Since 2018, e-scooters have been operating on Portland streets in a pilot. Sorry, I'm just reading this for the first time and it's not okay. I took action to prevent their unauthorized deployment and had PBOT create rules and regulations for these new technologies. Today is an opportunity for City Council to see data and information about the two e-scooter pilots and to learn what the pilots have taught us as PBOT moves forward with creating a permanent e-scooter program. For reference, these lessons are also summarized in both the 2018 and the 2019 e-scooter findings reports, which include data-driven recommendations. I look forward to hearing from PBOT about the e-scooter pilot programs, especially about how, at my direction, PBOT instituted a first-in-the-nation requirement for e-scooter companies to analyze their climate impacts. That requirement is helping cities and the industry understand the potential for e-scooters to get people out of cars and pursue cleaner options that combat the climate crisis. I also look forward to hearing more about how safe infrastructure investments, some of which are funded through Fixing Our Streets, have impacted e-scooter ridership. These topics and others are covered in the 2019 e-scooter findings report. Today, Council will have the opportunity to review the e-scooter report, its findings, and discuss recommendations as PBOT moves forward in its process to integrate e-scooters into Portland's transportation system. I'd now like to invite PBOT to share the report and their staff recommendations. We have Catherine here, I think.
Yes, thank you so much, Commissioner Udaly. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and Council. We appreciate you having us here today to talk about e-scooters. No one knows better than you, and we heard some of it this morning already, that this is a tough time for the city. So we're glad to bring something to you that we actually see as a bright spot. As Commissioner Udaly said, we're gonna share results from PBOT's most recent e-scooter pilot. And we're gonna talk about how those results show the potential to help support economic recovery, help provide equitable access for BIPOC Portlanders, and the very real potential to support our city climate goals. This is actually the first time we've formally brought this e-scooter program to you. We've been operating pilots since 2018, but we want to be clear that we see today's discussion not as an endpoint, but really as the beginning of the conversation. And we'll emphasize that several times throughout the course of the presentation today. We'll share the pilot findings, and as we talk about recommendations for what comes next, your questions, your comments will help shape those next steps. And so will the questions and comments that we get from stakeholders, from the broader community, both today and in the coming weeks. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Jacob Sherman.
Great, thanks, Catherine. Good morning, Mayor Wheeler, commissioners. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I work on new mobility and emerging technology at the Portland Bureau of Transportation, which means working on issues like Uber and Lyft and car share and bike share and scooters. I've been managing our scooter program for the last year. I'd like to take a quick opportunity to have my colleague Love Johnson also introduce herself as she'll be presenting with me.
Hi, everyone. My name is Love Johnson. I'm in the Active Transportation and Safety Division, working closely with Jacob and Catherine on this program, and I really appreciate your time today.
Great.
So, thank you, Jacob. And before you go on, I never introduced myself. My apologies for that. I am Catherine Charlo, and I manage the Active Transportation and Safety Division. Thanks.
So we'd like to provide a little bit of background about e-scooters in Portland. Starting with kind of the question, why e-scooters? As Catherine had mentioned, PBOT actually prevented the unauthorized deployment of e-scooters on our streets in 2018. I know some members of this council have had experience with those issues in the past, and we decided that we were not going to let technology occur for technology's sake alone, but really determine whether and how e-scooters could help advance city goals, particularly goals around congestion and climate, safety, equitable access. So in 2018, we launched a 120-day long pilot. It involved three companies. And at the end of that pilot, we prepared kind of an extensive report, which we can make available for you and is appended to the resolution, finding that the majority of Portlanders viewed e-scooters positively. Portlanders were primarily using e-scooters for transportation purposes. There were challenges with e-scooters, and some of those challenges remain today, and we're going to talk with you about our strategies to address those challenges around sidewalk riding and improper parking, and then challenges around equitable access. And given those findings, our recommendation at the end of the 2018 pilot was that we conduct a second pilot in order to collect more data and test new solutions to some of those challenges. So in 2019, we launched a second pilot test some of the potential solutions to those challenges. The graphic kind of on your right, I recognize is small. It's an excerpt from our report, but want to just highlight a few things in terms of testing new ways around compliance in order to make sure that people are parking scooters properly. We also introduced seated scooters into the system from some questions and concerns we heard from people with different ability levels wanting safer models. And then as Catherine had said, instituting kind of a first in the nation requirement to assess kind of the climate benefits, if any, for e-scooters. It was a competitive process, and there's been a lot of change kind of in the market. We had six companies operating, we're down to four today, mainly because of market forces. And some of those market forces continue in the sense of COVID and the impacts of COVID on the e-scooter industry, as well as some of the racial justice demonstrations that have been occurring have also had an impact on the scooter business in our city. I want to just provide a little bit of some of the high level kind of riding statistics. So you can see that in the 2018 and 2019 calendar years, we've had a total of 1.7 million trips. In the 2020 calendar year, we've had about more than 425,000 rides. You can see our fleet has kind of varied from between 2 to about roughly 3,000 scooters. People ride kind of all over the city, we've seen. The average trip distance in 2019 was just over a mile long. Interestingly enough, we've seen the trip characteristics change during the pandemic, and trips are now longer. We've also seen, I think really importantly, the impact of some of our requirements on, around equitable access. So PBOT has required the companies to deploy 15% of their scooters each day in East Portland. And this has resulted in 6% of their total rides occurring in East Portland. We believe that without any of these requirements, the companies may not have placed scooters in places like East Portland. Because there's not a ton of demand there. For example, places like the St. John's neighborhood and the Brentwood-Darlington neighborhood have not had many rides there. And that's because we've seen that there haven't been many scooters provided on the streets there. We think some of these requirements are really important. We wanted to just share that with you. Also want to point out that, you know, most of the information you're getting in this presentation today is because PBOT requires the companies to share data with us for compliance and planning purposes. PBOT's worked really closely with Smart Cities PDX to develop a strong practice around data privacy. And I'd really like to thank Kevin Martin and his team for some of the work that we've done to comply with the privacy and information protection principles, which this council passed last year. We've learned a lot, and some of the learning at PBOT is kind of being scaled into other bureaus. And what some of the data shows is that when we create safe places to ride, it boosts ridership. So this is an example of a project in Northeast Portland where between the first pilot and the second pilot, we had a major capital improvement project in order to create safe infrastructure. And you could see that with scooters, this resulted in 125% increase in ridership in just 1 year. We think that scooters are also kind of a proxy for cycling. And so we would anticipate that it's also had a positive impact there as well. The data has also pretty clearly shown us, and this is in the report, that some of our strategies around education and in-app rules have helped move riders out of places like Waterfront Park and onto some of the safe infrastructure that we've created, like Better NATO. Gonna shift gears a little bit and share with you some of the information about the changing perceptions of e-scooters in Portland. And it's really interesting hearing some of the comments this morning about drones. This is a topic that we are also interested in. And I think it's really important to say that, you know, the future and change often sparks resistance. Some of that is justified because I think we need to ask questions about whether and how these technologies help us advance our community identified goals. So we're at PBOT, we're thinking a lot about some of this. This is the space where I work, you know, from drone delivery to autonomous vehicles to sidewalk delivery robots. These things are real in other cities that are exploring some of these. And our, you know, initial response to innovation is often fear and resistance, sometimes justifiably so. And this has been happening for a long time. I think it's just important to point out that, you know, when automobiles first came, over 100 years ago, there were similar sentiments. And our role as the Bureau of Transportation and the government is to manage some of that disruption and change and manage it towards our goals. Fortunately, I think we have a lot of experience here. We've dealt with this. Commissioner Fritz in particular has dealt with some of these issues around Uber and Lyft. And this is really why we prevented kind of the rogue deployment and launch of scooters in our city and created these pilots in order to, again, examine whether and how they meet our goals. The two pilots, I'd say, have shown both support and concerns for e-scooters. The majority of complaints were focused on issues around sidewalk riding and, sidewalk riding and improper parking.
Excuse me for a second, Jacob. I see from Philip Wolf that the captioning is not working. Can we pause for a moment and check on that?
Sure.
You were on a roll, and this is a fabulous presentation, but we have to make sure we're
Yes, thanks, Commissioner Hardesty. Keelan, can you let us know when that might be working so we can proceed?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. We are troubleshooting now to see if we can get those captions back up. Oh, okay, looks like we're good to go.
Are we good to go? Thank you.
Thanks, Keelan.
Thank you. As I was saying, the majority of complaints that we've received at the Bureau have been focused on two issues around improper parking and sidewalk riding. We did an analysis of some of the complaints. We found that 42% of the complaints we received were submitted by three individuals. And over time, we've seen that complaints have decreased as riders have learned the rules of the road and the community has adapted to some of that change. I do think it's important to point out that there are more complaints downtown than in other parts of the city. And that's probably because the vast majority of scooter trips occur downtown and a large number of scooters are down there. The images here, we have an image of a scooter blocking an ADA ramp. We also have an image of an excerpt from the Scoot Smart video that we partnered with Disability Rights Oregon, some other advocacy groups, and the company Lime in order to produce and share. So I want to briefly share a little bit of where we are as an agency in moving beyond the pilot programs. So we published our scooter findings report in September. We've been doing stakeholder engagement throughout both of the pilots, and we've just launched into a new phase of that stakeholder engagement, which we'll be talking about in more detail later. The plan is to, through this stakeholder engagement process, solicit feedback and input both from council as well as from the community in order to help us develop and publish kind of a solicitation, an RFP, an RFQ, something like that, that we would put on the streets. We would see which companies respond to that. We negotiate those contracts and ideally be launching a new program in 2020. And we'll be engaging, you know, with council and your staff on some of the details of that. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Love Johnson, who's going to talk us through some of the findings from our 2019 scooter findings report.
Great. Thanks, Jacob. So we published recently a report on the 2019 pilot. So that covers when the pilot started in April of 2019 through the end of the year. I'm just going to walk through three kind of big buckets of findings that we have on these slides today. So first, some points around safety. So throughout the 2018 and 2019 pilots, we worked with Multnomah County Health Department to track injuries that came through their emergency rooms that are related to e-scooters. And we found basically injury rates are consistent with other cities. We've had no deaths in Portland. And the majority of injuries are from riders falling, so not colliding with anyone else or any objects, just sort of falling on their own. We see that helmet use remains low, but Portlanders, you know, people who live here are more likely to have helmets in there than visitors are. We've also seen, you know, an evolution over the two pilots that user behavior is generally improving as people learn the rules of the road and as people sort of get used to having scooters on the streets. Part of that is due to, you know, just sort of novelty wearing off, and part of it's due to sort of some changes that PBOT has made throughout the pilots in response to what we've heard. Companies are required to provide information about the rules of the road in Portland in their apps for people to read before they ride. And during this pilot, PBOT started doing some citations of our own. And so PBOT staff were out, not doing traffic stops or stopping people, but issuing penalties.
Hello. Excuse me. Could I interrupt for just a sec, please? Uh-huh. I need to go back and ask this question because Commissioner Fritz isn't here yet. When you say helmet use remains low, what does that mean? What's the percentage of people who use helmets and those who don't?
Yeah, I think, so we have done user surveys of e-scooter riders three times. So during the 2019 pilot, I think the numbers are around 20% of people say they always or usually wore helmets. And then the rest of folks either sometimes or don't wear helmets. So that's kind of where we're at now.
I'm sorry, I missed that last part. Where are we now?
About our latest survey showed that about 20% of people are wearing helmets, always or most of the time.
And do you have data broken down by demographic age groups?
We do, yeah. We could definitely break that down.
I'm just curious, and I know if Commissioner Fritz was here, she'd be asking about the helmet, so I felt it important to put it on the record what the percentage is. Thank you.
Great, yeah, thank
you. And it sounds like you're speaking through a tunnel.
Oh.
Can I ask a follow-up question to Commissioner Hardesty's question? And you may not be able to answer this question right now, but it's one that concerns me. So we know that helmet use is low, just as it is in other cities. And we know that that's very dangerous. If we approve this program knowing that helmet use is low and knowing that it's dangerous, who takes on the implicit liability? Is it the scooter provider, or does the city of Portland and its taxpayers take on that liability? Whose concern is this?
Mayor, I'll take a first stab at that answer, and then Jacob will probably fill in as well. We have worked closely with the city attorneys to date. Throughout our permit program, we have been clear with the permittees that the city is not accepting liability, and we require a significant insurance policy for those companies to cover that liability. It's still honestly being worked through the systems nationwide throughout different cities. We will continue, obviously, to work really closely with our city attorney. To date, they have not felt like the city is taking on that liability. One of the things we're interested in, and we'll talk about this more as we move through the presentation, is actually shifting the program structure to a place where we have a less broad regulatory field and a closer regulatory relationship with a smaller number of companies, which hopefully will help us partner to answer, to address some challenges, including the helmet.
I just want to make sure, and I understand there's probably no perfect solution here. The city right. will, of course, get sued anyway if somebody's out there and they run into a bad track or whatever, and they go flying and they're not wearing a helmet. The city will, of course, be sued. But I want to make sure that we are not accepting undue liability for other people's personal behavior and personal decisions. And I would, of course, also assume that when somebody logs in to one of the scooter users' apps, that the app makes it crystal clear.
Absolutely.
A, they're supposed to wear a helmet. B, they're supposed to be appropriate age. And C, by using the app, they are accepting all personal liability. Are these things all true?
Yes, these are all true.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mayor Wheeler. I'm going to move us on.
One other question, sorry, since I'm on a roll and then I'll stop, but I don't want to lose my train of thought. So let's say a minor child decides to use one of these scooters. And we know that happens because we've all seen it, right? And so they log on using the app and they themselves say, sure, they're old enough to use this scooter. But they're not of an age of consent where they actually can sign the document and have it legally upheld anyway. So whose liability is that?
It's a great question.
I was just going to say, I would want, I think, to confer with city attorneys before speculating on that. But Jacob, maybe you have, based on your experience, you've seen how this plays out in other places.
I'll agree with Catherine on we should probably talk with council about that particular issue, but I'll address the first part of that about a minor using the services. I think we do have some kind of trade-offs that we can consider in terms of some companies are requiring users to submit photo documentation of their driver's license as they register to into the app, and you know, must be of a certain age in order to use those services. So there is an opportunity there. Of course, there then becomes a trade-off on the other side in terms of people who are undocumented. who might not, you know, be able to provide some of that. And so I think those are some considerations that we'd be happy to just continue to discuss with you and council staff as we're thinking about how we move beyond these pilots. And then of course we can speak with council around that particular issue of liability.
Okay, and I don't want to gum this up because you've got a really good presentation here and I'll let you run with it. But I just want to, again, underscore that we're not the only city confronting this. This is a system-wide issue and it's been broadly discussed for several years. And at some point, I'd just like to know what the current assessment of liability is for the city of Portland and its taxpayers.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. We'll bring that back to you. We'll confer with the city attorney's office and get back to council on that.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So I'll hand, go ahead, Love.
Hopefully my sound is better. If not, let me know. Some of the safety concerns we've heard are from people with disabilities and people walking who are concerned about scooters being parked improperly on the sidewalk. So these photos just show some ways we could manage that. On the left here shows what's called a lock-to system. So some cities have moved towards the sort of dockless free-floating model that we have in Portland now to a system where they require scooters to be equipped with a cable lock and parked at bike racks. San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Chicago are some places that have seen a lot of success with this and even called it sort of key to their program. And then on the right here shows a parking corral. So this is dedicated space either on the street or on the sidewalk for e-scooter parking. So kind of just thinking about trade-offs there in terms of how we want to use the right-of-way, whether that's using parking space for cars in the street to make these or using sort of space where sidewalk tables could go. But those are two of the things we're thinking about. Now I'll talk about some findings related to equity. You can see on the right here some results from a citywide representative poll that we did in 2018 that showed that people of color and people living on low incomes viewed e-scooters positively. As I mentioned, we've done three surveys of e-scooter riders in 2018, 2019, and winter 2020, so earlier this year. And we were looking at how responses from BIPOC Portlanders differed from responses from white Portlanders, and we found some interesting things here. One is that BIPOC Portlanders are more likely to ride e-scooters because they don't have a car compared to white people, so 23% versus 13%. And also BIPOC Portlanders said they would be more likely to ride scooters if more were available near transit. So really using it as a last mile to transit connection. On the other hand, there are lots of barriers for folks riding e-scooters that we think will take some thoughtful management to overcome. On the right here, we can see that, you know, e-scooters are not the cheapest way to travel. They currently cost more than a lot of other modes. Some other barriers we've heard through focus groups that we've done with Black Portlanders, East Portlanders, and Portlanders with disabilities are around cost, as I mentioned, road safety. So having a place to ride separated from cars and bike infrastructure, travel needs. So, you know, maybe people are just traveling with families and e-scooters don't work for that. Concerns around race-based harassment, profiling, sort of violence in the right-of-way, as has been highlighted this summer, and reliable access. So are e-scooters available near where I live or near where I need to go? As Jacob showed earlier, our sort of minimum deployment requirements in East Portland were a good start to increasing e-scooter ridership there, but not sufficient to make them work for everyone. So in the future, we think that both PBOT and companies need to have deeper partnerships with community-based organizations that are out there serving folks in community. Think about ways to reduce the cost of e-scooters and expand access geographically and otherwise. And then really thinking about safety in infrastructure, so bike infrastructure and beyond infrastructure. So how do we address these personal safety questions that our Black and brown neighbors are facing?
Love, I have a question. Why is it so much more expensive to ride a scooter than it is to ride a bike?
Question, yeah. So between 2018 and 2019, we saw the prices go up across e-scooter companies. So in 2018, it's about 15 cents a minute. In 2019, it's 27, 28 cents a minute. And that's sort of just the economics of the scooter companies right now. But I think if we were to move forward with a longer term model in which we had sort of a procurement process where we picked vendors, we would have some ability to negotiate with them on a pricing structure. And Jacob and Kathy, if you want to fill in on that, you're welcome to.
Thank you, Love. I might add one thing, which is this isn't the answer I think you wanted, Commissioner, but the e-bikes are somewhat more expensive. I don't have an exact figure, a per trip figure. This figure was calculated before we had e-bikes. You would see it be a little higher now. And we've talked about that with council before, that was one of the trade-offs to get wider coverage and get the e-bike benefit. And what we've done in the context of Bike Town is really try to beef up our subsidies for particularly vulnerable communities through Bike Town for All. And as Lev said, the recommended model that we would like to talk about here would move us toward that type of relationship where we may be able to do that type, have that type of program more easily with a provider.
So I think we all understand that the higher the cost, the less likely BIPOC communities will benefit from this mode of transportation.
Right.
Right. And I'll just note, go ahead, Jacob.
I was just going to maybe note the same thing that you were. Commissioner Hardesty, earlier in the pandemic, we partnered with one scooter company to actually waive some of the fees that PBOT has in order to kind of unlock an ability for the company where they decided to discount rides by 50%. And when that happened, we actually kind of saw explosive growth of ridership in East Portland. I think it was 136% increase, despite the fact that a lot of people were still staying home. And so I think that this focus on price is one of the things that we're really interested in, and interested in kind of trying to better understand in what remains of the pilot so that we can move into kind of a more informed space as we're thinking about negotiating on these topics with companies in the future.
Yes, and one last thing is that we do have a low income option. I would say, have been marginally successful under the current structure in signing people up for that option. And so that is one of the improvements we would like to see made as we move forward with it.
And what is low income as far as scooter companies are concerned?
Oh, I don't want to speculate too much, Jacob. I'm going to turn it over to you.
I was going to hand it to Love.
Yeah, I'll take that. Right now, scooter companies are required to offer a low-income plan, and they're pretty similar across the board in terms of eligibility. It's basically if you are eligible for or enrolled in SNAP, EBT, if you live in affordable housing, if you're eligible for utility bill discounts, things like that. We have a page on our website where that's kind of laid out for each company. As Catherine said, the signups that companies have gotten are generally pretty low because, as you might expect, they're not necessarily incentivized to publicize a cheaper rate. But we have found a pretty good example of sort of deeper partnership in a PBOT program, which is the Transportation Wallet for Residents of Affordable Housing Program. And I won't go into too much detail, but basically we worked with residents of affordable housing to help get them signed up for those low-income plans. And that's where the majority of the plans came from, the signups came from. So that's something we want to see more of in the future. And the companies are also required to offer ways for people to pay in cash and ways for people to access scooters without having to have a smartphone. So those are things we've tested out in this year, and we want to see continue.
I see Commissioner Udaly also wanted to get in on this conversation.
My last point, I just want to make sure that we don't sign any contract that we clearly cannot articulate that BIPOC communities will be able to benefit, and understanding that there are many BIPOC communities that have more than one child. It looks like the captioning is not working again, Mayor, and Philip Wolf has notified us of that.
Keelan, can you look into that? And Commissioner Daly wanted to jump in on this point.
I'm going to wait for the captioning to come back on. Okay, it's working now.
I wasn't finished my sentence, Mayor. Yeah. Give me just a second. You Daly, no worry. Again, I think when we're getting ready to intentionally put a system in place, we must make sure that BIPOC communities really will benefit and not hope that somewhere down the line that they actually are the beneficiaries of this new contract. So thank you.
Thank you.
This is exciting work, but at the same time, the higher the price, the more we cost people out of being able to participate, which is exactly opposite of our goal. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thanks, Commissioner Hardesty. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. First, Love, I want to mention there's a lot of static on your line, and it's difficult. It's intermittently difficult to understand what you're saying. So I don't know if you have another option for a speaker, microphone, or phone, but.
Commissioner Udaly, I can also take the remaining slides if necessary, just so
okay,
we can.
Okay, yeah.
Unless Love has another microphone.
I'm honestly struggling to follow along due to the interference on the line. I just want to say that I am really proud of the work that we did on the second pilot. Well, first of all, the data sharing is a big deal. Like, we've been smart about negotiating with these companies from the beginning, but in the second pilot, because Portland's such a desirable market, we were really able to push these companies on equity issues in multiple ways. So the seated scooters to expand people's ability to use scooters. I believe we have providers, now I'm hesitating, but I think there's multiple languages available. We've got the reduced fees. We've got payment method, which we know is a challenge. Like, we really pushed them, and the way we did that was the more they met our equity and the East Portland deployment, the more they met our equity requirements, the more likely they were able to participate at all, but also I think they got bonuses as far as being able to deploy more scooters. So there's absolutely room for improvement, but I would say that we are probably light years ahead of most cities in the work that we're doing. So I love all the feedback. Definitely want to make them as accessible as possible. But just really wanted to highlight the fact that we're very cognizant of these issues. And I think the team has been really creative and effective in advancing the equity concerns. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner Udaly. I want to move on to some of the other innovation that we've been focused on as a city in this second pilot. I think through some of the research that we've done, you know, we've seen that some e-scooters are replacing car trips, both personal vehicle as well as private for hire, including Uber and Lyft trips. We've also seen that some scooter trips replace low carbon modes, such as walking or biking or taking a bus. I think over time through the user surveys that we've been done for the last 3 years, we've seen that generally trips are shifting from kind of recreation, from some recreation to much more transportation. And given kind of Portland's first in the nation requirement for these life cycle analyses that came out of your specific request, Commissioner Udaly, we've been able to kind of ascertain that we do think scooters provide a net positive climate benefit, especially because of the trip replacement of Uber and Lyft trips in particular, which have a really high emissions profile.
Jacob, if I could just jump in for a second to elaborate a little bit on the life cycle analysis. We know that companies engage in greenwashing and they try to sell products to us with the claim that it's, you know, they're more sustainable or more green. And I'm pretty skeptical of all of these companies. Where these scooters are made, who makes them, what they're made out of, how long they will last, whether the parts are recyclable, all factor into whether it is legitimately a greener option. Certainly we know it's not greener than biking and walking. So I'm really excited to see the results of the life cycle analysis and push the industry to do better. We know that the first rollout of scooters, these seemed like flimsy toys that were not gonna have long lives. And, you know, there's the challenge of built-in obsolescence. Companies are constantly changing things and making their products, old products, out of date. So now we're seeing more rugged, I guess, I'd say scooters are gonna have longer lives. So it's really exciting. And I had no idea that this would be, have an impact on a national level. So thanks for making sure that happened. I know I throw a lot of requests at you guys.
Well, and I'd like to thank some of my colleagues, in particular, Eric Hesse and Mel Kurniajic, who we've worked really closely with on this. So it's been a team effort here at PBOT, and we're happy to share some of these findings in more detail with you later. And I do think there's an opportunity for us as we move forward to think about how we can further maximize the benefits and kind of mitigate some of the downsides. Want to shift a little bit to the future and how we're thinking about a future program that helps us maximize on those city goals. So as we've kind of discussed here, the world has changed, and you know that, you're dealing with this every day, but the micromobility industry, the shared scooters and shared bikes and other light electric vehicles has significantly changed. You know, venture capital flowed freely in 2018. It's incredibly limited now. Companies are literally going out of business because they can't fundraise. The companies were focused on growth and just, you know, burning through money, and now they're focused really closely on profitability. Companies are closing, companies are leaving markets. We've had two companies leave our market because of profitability issues. And, you know, the ongoing impacts of COVID and the uncertainty around that just means that we are in an entirely different place. And I know that you understand that from the city perspective, and I'm just talking about it from the itty bitty little scooter perspective. And these are things that we need to consider as an agency as we're moving forward. And we also need to kind of assess our own skills and capabilities, particularly limited staff capacity within the agency, particularly within the larger city budget environment. The challenges that we face engaging nearly a half dozen companies and the relationship management and the compliance and enforcement, all of those things, it's really hard. And comparing and contrasting this against the benefits that we've seen of a different model, the model that we've have through our bike share contract with Biketown. And so all of this has really taken us as an agency to kind of recommend a new approach. And what we're here to share is kind of based on these findings, we are recommending as staff that we pursue longer term contracts with some of the companies, that we limit the amount of companies from as few as one, you know, potentially an exclusive, to maybe three different companies. And that, as Catherine had kind of mentioned, with a much deeper focus on partnerships and community benefit. And we think that this new management approach will allow us to better use city resources. It'll allow those city resources, those staff, to focus on some of the things that matter, like innovation and safety and equity. And it'll also provide benefits to the companies that are awarded these contracts. It'll give them stability and certainty to be able to invest in our community. And it'll allow them to better focus on delivering those community benefits and meeting city goals.
Excuse me for a second, Jacob. Cat's name is off again. Is that a problem that we can permanently fix?
Thank you, Commissioner. Let me see if we can troubleshoot.
Thank you.
I can slow down a little bit.
No, you should. We'll need to stop until the captioning is back on. Thank you.
Okay, it looks like the captioning is back. Thank you.
Thank you. So as I was saying, we believe that a limited number of longer term contracts will let the companies be better positioned in order to help us provide community benefit and meet our goals. So this is kind of our recommendation that we're almost at the end of our presentation. We're happy to talk more about this. And I want to just shift ever so slightly, unless there's a questions. I saw a few screens turn on about some of the community engagement work that we're doing around these recommendations. So as I mentioned, we've been doing community engagement work throughout almost the past 2 years that we've had scooters on the streets, and we've just turned into kind of a new phase of that work in order to kind of engage stakeholders around these recommendations and some of these management strategies like lock to requirements, like negotiating on price, and et cetera, et cetera. We've been engaging our Bureau advisory committees in these conversations. We already have scheduled a number of kind of focused engagement sessions with stakeholders that represent seniors and our elders, that represent people with disabilities, and that represent BIPOC Portlanders, as well as kind of other stakeholders from the central city. A number of these are scheduled. We're planning on kind of wrapping up this phase of public input and engagement before Thanksgiving, and then continuing the conversation with council offices. We currently have a questionnaire available online, and that's been distributed through a number of our PBOT channels about some of these management strategies that we're exploring. So Catherine, this is over to you in terms of some of our next steps.
Great, thank you. So just wrapping up with the timeline that you have already seen, but we wanted to put it in a slightly different frame, less about the progress of the project and more, or the program, and more about how what we're hearing today will be incorporated and when. So we will create a feedback memo from today's session and from the ongoing engagement that we're conducting currently. We'll use that feedback, in addition to the feedback we've heard from the pilots all along, to help inform the call for proposals that Jacob described. Not entirely clear yet whether it'll be an RFP, an RFI, or an RFQ. We're still working through that. Part of the reason we're still working through it is we're waiting to see what feels most appropriate for the kinds of input that we get. But in any case, that input will help us shape both the actual requirements in that solicitation and the criteria by which we'll evaluate responses to that solicitation. So we want both to set out clear requirements and to leave some room for creativity of respondents to share their strategies with us. We will share that draft solicitation with your staff, get input on it, and then of course we will be back in front of you to have any contracts approved. And Commissioner Hardesty, thank you for your clear direction there. We will make sure that we're in touch closely with you even before we bring those contracts. We are looking at early 2021. It all depends on how quickly we can move through this. And I just wanted to thank Jacob and Love for their fabulous work, really bringing in a lot of different viewpoints for this work, and welcome you all to ask us questions and give us input. Thanks.
Colleagues, any questions?
I have a couple of questions. Thank you so much. Let me just say that was an excellent presentation. It was engaging, very interesting indeed. I'm going to ask about helmets. The last time we were doing the pilots, we asked if there were ways to make the helmets attached to the scooter, or if there were opportunities to create kind of disposable helmets. Has there been any new developments in connecting helmets to scooters?
Jacob, do you want to answer that?
Sure, thanks, Catherine. Commissioner Hardesty, I have not seen a lot of progress from the industry on this issue. There are in other cities shared mopeds. And I can speak there in the shared mopeds because it's a larger vehicle. They've actually included on the back a container that a shared helmet goes in, and they actually have like a little hairnet that a person can put on, or they have a box of hairnets in there that a person can put on before they put the helmet on. So, you know, there is, I guess, a solution there, but that's also different than a scooter, you know, which is smaller than a moped. And I think this is one of those areas that, you know, we can, and industry is here, and we'll be sharing some of their testimony with us later. I think this is one of those places where, you know, at the direction of our leadership, you know, we can make strong signals to industry of what we're going to expect as we're thinking about the future of these devices in our city.
Yeah, we're never going to get over that 20% if we don't require some innovation around how do we make sure that that people can ride these new transportation options safely. And so I would highly strongly encourage some innovation before you come back with a contract, because I think we can continue to be a national model, but we have to actually demand safety for our residents rather than waiting for the industry to accommodate people riding safely. So, excellent work. I look forward to continuing the conversation. It's always very thought-provoking and innovative. I think one last thing I wanted to say to Jacob, though it's true that people probably didn't like the automobile because they thought it would replace the horse way back when. I do think that we have to balance new innovative technology with safety, with privacy, with all the other issues that we balance, that we have to balance when we're making decisions and policies. So nobody here is afraid of innovation, but everybody here is concerned about safety and making sure that our communities, all of our communities, can prosper. So again, thanks for the presentation.
Thank you for that comment, Commissioner Hardesty. Really appreciate it. And I think it's one of those relevant things for us to be thinking about as we're talking about some of these other issues like drones. So right. Very relevant.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, thank you. That was a wonderful.
Commissioner, before we could we go off the presentation so we can see who's actually speaking? Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. Sorry, Commissioner Ryan. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Peabot. That was a great presentation and very thorough. I think I thought you were smart to start off with how this is implementing across the country, and it's messy, and we're in a testing mode right now. We should always be in a continuous improvement testing mode, of course, but especially at the beginning. I also think the themes of access, equity, of course, connected at the front and center of that, and safety really rose up as our main concerns. And I can see that you're working on that. Two things were that I've heard all my comments from my colleagues, and they've been great. So I'll try to add a little bit to that. I think a lot of Portlanders are just confused about when it comes to safety. What is the other citations? Is there traffic citations? I saw that PBOT does those, but I don't even know what the citation would be. But it seems like there is a compliance accountability mechanism that is in the system for safety. And I really wasn't hearing any concrete system for that. And so I must have missed something, and I look forward to being educated right now.
Jacob, why don't you speak to that, and then we can add a little bit about profiling concerns if we need to.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. So in the first pilot, 2018, we had no kind of compliance and enforcement. We did a lot of education. And I think one of the things that we learned was to try and test some new strategies around compliance specifically. So partnering with our colleagues over in the PBOT regulatory division, which, we had regulatory specialists doing compliance work primarily around improper parking. And so you might have noticed that the scooters now have a kind of a large 5 or 6 digit number on the front of those scooters, and kind of like a rental car. If you go over a toll bridge and don't pay the toll, the car company gets back to you at the end of the day, and you're going to have to pay for that. So we instituted a similar system where our regulatory specialists could find a scooter that was improperly parked, take an appropriate picture, log the GPS coordinates and time, and then we would send those as a bill to the company for them to pay us with the expectation that they would pass that on to the user. So we issued nearly 1,000 penalties and warnings, the vast majority of them for improper parking. And some of that is also because PBOT does not have authority to do traffic stops. So riding on the sidewalk is a moving violation, and we have no regulatory authority to be able to engage in that space. And as Catherine kind of indicated, I think there's also concerns about bias and how we choose some of that enforcement. Ticketing for a scooter that's left there with no user around, so we don't know who left it there, that's slightly different than actually doing a traffic stop. So that would be my answer. We think this is a place that we need to continue working, and we're looking forward to talking with our partners in regulatory about how we can keep doing this kind of moving forward. We also think, though, that solutions like this locking to mechanism that other cities, San Francisco, DC, Chicago have done, might help us not need to focus as much on compliance because it would just be required to be locked up in the first place.
Thank you, Jacob. And I notice your engagement sessions are an opportunity to drill deeper into this, among other issues. And I just wanted to ask, when it comes to the elderly seniors, what does that engagement look like? Who are the groups that you're meeting? Who are your partners in that space, in that sector, if you will?
Love, can we test your microphone and see if it's how well it's working? Because you've been a little bit more on point than I have.
We can. Let me know if this is better. Okay. So, we're putting together a couple of focus groups and making ourselves available in other ways because we know times are really crazy right now. So we're putting together one focus group with a disability rights advocacy groups and people with, and older adults. And so some of the partners we're working with there, Disability Rights Board and AARP. We're working with staff at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability who work on sort of aging in place and issues like that. Let's see, offhand, that's who I can think of. Jacob, maybe you can think of some other partners.
Yeah, thanks. I'm trying to see if I can kind of quickly pull some of this up. So we have reached out to AARP. We've reached out to colleagues at the Office of Equity and Human Rights, Alan De La Torre in the mayor's office, just kind of scanning a list, Independent Living Resources, Metropolitan Family Services, and a number of kind of disability advocacy groups, including Disability Rights Oregon. And if you have recommendations, Commissioner Ryan, we'd be very interested in hearing them. Some of these sessions are coming up in a few weeks, so there's still opportunity to invite other stakeholders to engage.
Yeah, if you could send our office that list, and then we could respond. And I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner Ryan. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. I just want to thank the team for a great conversation and thank Council for engaging. This has been, I think, really helpful. I wanted to just note a few things real quick. One is safety and compliance with rules, and particular scooters not creating a danger or an obstacle to people with disabilities, whether they have mobility challenges, blind or vision impaired, were top priorities for me. So I'm really pleased to see the progress on this. I do think that the we could compel the companies to have a stricter kind of education component that you have to go through in order to unlock the app and use the scooters. And I also think we need to do more public education and outreach. And that includes laws around helmets, because they're not entirely consistent. I think there's still confusion. Helmets for bicycle riders, I believe, including e-bikes, are not required for 16 and over. Do I have that right? But helmets are required for e-scooters, which, you know, e-bikes go faster than e-scooters. They're heavier than e-scooters. And I believe people also ride them further distances than e-scooters. So our state laws are inconsistent and I think are contributing to the confusion around whether or not helmets are required. Helmets are required for e-scooters by law for everyone. Let's see. I also want to note, Jacob mentioned that we have no regulatory authority for moving violations. That's not PBOT passing the buck, that's state law. We have no authority. We cannot enforce on moving violations unless state law is changed. And I believe that will also require a change in the Oregon Constitution. Not to say it's not possible, but it's certainly not something that we can achieve on the city level alone. The mayor asked some questions about insurance, and I don't think we went into all the details I have here, so I'm going to share the details I have. PBOT's going to be working with the National Association of City Transportation Officials, that's NACTO, and the North American Bike Share Association to examine national practices around insurance requirements. Moving forward, we'll be working closely with the city attorney's office to ensure the city is protected and protecting both riders and pedestrians, and consider the right balance between insurance requirements and hurdles to small businesses and organizations. I share your concerns, especially about youth using the scooters improperly, whether their parents allow them to or not, and what liability the city may face. So that's an issue we are delving into and take very seriously. And I think I've got, I've covered everything. And I just wanna say from the outset, I wasn't the commissioner in charge for the first pilot. I was somewhat skeptical of e-scooters. They seem fun, and I kind of liked how the city turned into a playground in a way when we had that first pilot, but I didn't appreciate residents acting like five-year-olds and leaving their scooters all littered all over the city. So I'm glad we've made progress there. And I saw a question pop up, I think, in the chat. Yes, I use e-scooters. When we rolled out the second pilot, I tried it for the first time and actually used scooters several times to just get around downtown. I enjoyed it. I have to say I'd like better shock absorbers because my brain feels very rattled after I get off of a scooter. But they're fun and they're a great option, especially for that last mile and taking short trips. And I will leave it there. I think unless there's further questions, we just move on to public comment or if staff wants to respond to anything I just said.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Daly, and thank you to the staff. That was actually a fantastic presentation. I really appreciate it. Keelan, how many people do we have signed up for public testimony?
Looks like we have about 10 people on the line.
All right, very good. 3 minutes each. Name for the record, please.
First person is William Henderson.
Good morning.
Hello, looks like I'm on here. My name is William Henderson. I'm the founder of Rag Report, which is based in Portland. Also a founding board member of Business for a Better Portland. I listened to the whole report. It was great, I agree. And I'm sure you've also heard plenty from scooter companies about how a permanent program is gonna help make it easier for them to improve and expand their services. So I just wanted to give you a different angle on it, which is how a permanent program will solidify Portland's role as a leader and sort of an innovation center in this small growing industry. So our story actually began when I approached PBOT with an idea. This was about 5 years ago. I was really excited about how GPS and sensor data could be used to support a transition to a more sustainable and equitable transportation system. I was also very concerned that this data would be used in a just way without creating new systems for corporate or public surveillance. And then with the sudden arrival of these internet-connected bikes and scooters, we knew what we had to do. So PBOT was an early customer and a partner. And now we're a growing company with 18 full-time employees. We're working with over 70 cities around the world. And, you know, I think you've probably realized this during the presentation, but within this world of micromobility, which is sort of industry parlance for bikes and scooters and small electric vehicles, Portland is really a leader on the world stage. For example, Portland is one of the first cities to require that companies pay a fee each time they use the public right of way. And this fee is actually lower in East Portland. So it's sort of an effective subsidy for trips in that area. And this is now our practice that we've helped a bunch of other cities implement. So thanks to PBOT's leadership, we're seeing this industry, I think, evolve in a really different direction from ride hailing, which is sort of the industry that preceded it. And I think that's a really important thing that has impacts outside of the city itself. So by making this program permanent, you know, you will help our city meet these critical sustainability goals. You'll help ensure it happens in a way that is equitable. And you also will help make sure that Portland continues to lead the way worldwide on how these programs should work, how they can work for cities and all their residents. And then finally, you'll help create continued opportunities for local companies like ours, partnering with the city to provide these programs and make sure they're done the right way. Thank you.
Thank you, we appreciate your testimony.
Next, we have Phuong Nguyen.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Phuong Nguyen, and I'm a government partnerships manager for SPIN, one of the operators participating in the e-scooter pilot program. SPIN is committed to providing quality jobs with benefits in Portland. All of our employees here are in-house W-2 employees with living wages. And by rejecting a franchise and contractor workforce model, we're able to provide our employees with benefits, training, and protections that ensure quality of service. And since mid-March, when many other companies paused or suspended their operations across the country, SPIN has worked closely with PBOT to maintain service and fill transportation gaps. We have the largest service area and serve many neighborhoods with limited transportation options, like Foster, Woodstock, Multnomah Village, and Selwood. And with new expectations during the COVID-19 pandemic to socially distance, e-scooters offer a sustainable and compact mode of transportation to aid in the economic recovery of local businesses while easing congestion and pressure for parking. We welcome feedback on how SPIN can more effectively partner with the city and its agencies to build upon the shared progress we've made so far. And we're supportive of a permanent program with a limited number of qualified operators and considerations of past compliance and equitable service history. Thank you for your time, and we look forward to our continued collaboration.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Derek Aino.
Hi, Derek.
Morning, commissioners. My name is Derek Aino, and I lead community partnerships for SPIN in Portland. Portland is my home, and I'm personally committed to making sure SPIN's efforts serve our community. Since launching in April 2019, SPIN has worked closely with community stakeholders to serve local needs. When TriMet reduced service during stay-at-home orders, Our team implemented a robust cleaning protocol and continued to operate in the city to facilitate essential trips. During this time, we also offered free 30-minute unlimited rides to healthcare workers and partnered with local healthcare organizations like OHSU and Legacy Health to promote the program and to distribute free helmets. This program resulted in 16,000 free rides completely subsidized by SPIN in Portland. During the pilot, SPIN conducted numerous safety courses that drew hundreds of participants during last year's Sunday Parkways and also hosted safety demonstrations with PSU and Fourth Mobility. Due to COVID-19, SPIN has pivoted our rider safety and education training to a digital format. Through the SPIN Safe online portal, riders watch safety videos to understand safe riding behavior. Riders are incentivized to take a quiz after viewing the videos, with an opportunity to earn free SPIN credit for scoring 100% on the quiz and also have the opportunity to have a free helmet shipped to their door. SPIN is engaged with a broad range of stakeholders and organizations such as Rose Community Development, Reach Multnomah County, Hacienda CDC, Louisiana Flowers to promote the SPIN Safe program, and SPIN Access, which provides discounted rates and access to SPIN scooters without a smartphone or bank account. SPIN also participated in the PBOT transportation wallet for residents of affordable housing pilot and is currently the only scooter company in the parking transportation wallet program for the Northwest and Central East Side. Through this partnership, SPIN is also able to provide SPIN Access discounted rates for those who qualify for the gold transportation wallet by being a resident with a TriMet low income transit fare. Thank you for the opportunity to provide public comment today, and we appreciate your leadership during this uncertain time.
Thank you. Appreciate your support.
Next up, we have Tim Olberg.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Tim Olberg. I'm the head of government partnerships for SPIN, and we're one of the participants here in the city's e-scooter pilot program. I want to start off by thanking PBOT for the great work that they've done in putting together these pilots and really making sure that the companies that are operating in Portland are held accountable on issues such as access and equity. SPIN is committed to helping Portland overcome the transit and economic disruptions that you all have experienced due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In April and May of this year, after TriMet was forced to cut service, SPIN stepped up and began to work with PBOT on a first-of-its-kind partnership that provided discounts on scooter rides for essential trips. During the partnership, we saw some pretty striking scooter ridership increases along transit lines where the service had been reduced. So, for example, there was an increase in scooter trips starting and stopping near bus routes along the 44 and 19 routes. Also, when comparing the data prior to the stay-at-home order and during it, like PBOT mentioned previously today during their presentation, we saw a nearly 50% jump in overall ridership and an increase in equitable access with a nearly 150% jump in East Portland trips. SPIN was the first scooter company here in Portland to accurately geofence the parks in the city in order to limit the speed of the vehicles going through the parks. SPIN also has the ability to supplement Portland's recent investments in pedestrian and bike infrastructure by deploying dedicated parking and charging stations in collaboration with the city. We call these stations SPIN hubs, and they help the environment by decreasing emissions from our vans that we use to pick up our scooters, charge them at our warehouse, and then redeploy them the next day. These parking and charging stations have also helped to keep sidewalks clear and orderly for pedestrians and those in disabilities in cities where we've launched them. So regarding the future, SPIN definitely supports the permanent scooter program that's being proposed. We think that the city should take a look at requiring a history of compliance when vetting vendors. A proven track record of responsive operations in the city is a must, as well as employing workers, not independent contractors. We also request that PBOT not end the pilot before any procurement has been completed so that we can make sure that scooters continue to be an essential transportation service during the pandemic. So many thanks for your attention today. SPIN looks forward to a really bright transportation future here in Portland.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Next up, we have Maurice Henderson.
Yeah, and Keelan, before we go on, I just want to remind people of their obligations to state whether or not they're a lobbyist per council rules.
Thank you, Mayor, can you hear me?
I'm Maurice, loud and clear.
Okay, great, thank you. My name is Maurice Henderson for the record. I am the Senior Director of Government Partnerships at BIRD. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the current scooter pilot and the prospects for a permanent program. Our company operates scooter programs all over the world, and we have been extremely appreciative for the opportunity to provide our services to people of Portland in partnership with PBOT, local businesses, and community-based organizations since the first pilot in 2018. We applaud the city for the implementation of the shared e-scooter pilot that supported this community's stated economic, mobility, equity, congestion reduction, and sustainability goals, and appreciated Commissioner Udaly's comments regarding the life cycle analysis. We were proud to provide that information as well. We look forward to continuing to work with the City Council, PBOT, and community stakeholders to refine the regulatory environment that best supports attainment of those goals through the remainder of the current pilot and the prospect of the institution of the permanent program. BIRD looks forward to offering our expertise and experience operating over 100 cities globally, particularly during this new world with COVID-19 and at a time of the important heightened focus on social and environmental justice challenges. Also wanted to thank our community partners, Street Trust, Fourth Mobility, Latino Network, Rosewood Initiative, and others that we've participated in events and meaningful discussions specifically around scooter and pedestrian safety over the past year plus. Also have been very fortunate to be able to highlight local businesses through our app and other channels that we leverage to ensure that during this time of economic uncertainty, that people are, as they're using vehicles, able to get around and participate in the economic fabric of the community in Portland. I wanted to share two quick stories that give you a little different perspective. One is from a longtime friend of the city, Jenny Glass, the former executive director of Rosewood. Last year, I had an opportunity to sit down with Jenny, who I've known for a long time, and talk to her about scooters. And the first thing she said to me was, you know, I wasn't really excited about scooters when they first came, but then I noticed that a number of our constituents, the folks that we serve out in Far East Portland, were starting to show up for events, for the services that we offered, and other activities. And it was really the first time they'd been able to do that because now they had a transportation option in a place that had largely been a transportation desert to them. And she said, specifically, I noticed that they were showing up on these black and white BIRD scooters. The other story that really struck me a couple of weeks ago, I also had a chance to sit down with another good friend of the city and friend of mine, Rakiah Adams, who shared that during a recent protest, she saw scooter users leveraging the headlights on scooters to amplify and light up the hands of sign language interpreters so that differently abled participants could be able to follow along with speakers and clearly, you know, follow potential instructions in case something happened. So I thought these two stories were really instructive of some of the ancillary benefits that come from scooters that we don't always think about. And, you know, I think the economic sustainability, equity, and mobility goals that are being achieved through the program are things that we should hope to see going forward for residents and visitors. And BIRD looks forward to a fruitful partnership with the City of Portland and PBOT. Thank you.
Thank you, Maurice. Commissioner Daly, you have your hand raised. No, Commissioner Hardesty, you have your hand raised.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Maurice. It's always a pleasure to have you back at City Hall. And I'm putting that in quotes because we're all at virtual.
Thank you.
Maurice, are you a lobbyist for your firm?
I am not registered as a lobbyist in Portland. We have a lobbyist in Portland, though.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Mayor, it just sounded like the last three speakers were lobbyists or at least representing their firms. And so I just wanted to make sure that I asked that question. Thank you. And thank you, Maurice.
Yes.
Next up, we have Jonathan Hopkins.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners, and thank you for allowing me to speak on issue item 811. I'm Jonathan Hopkins. I do government affairs at Lyme. We are registered. I am registered as a lobbyist per code with the City of Portland. And Lyme is Portland's longest serving scooter provider. We're here to encourage commissioners to make the best scooter program in the country a permanent fixture of our city. Portland's long led the country in embracing transportation options before peer cities, from light rail to streetcars to bike share. Scooter share is but another example of this leadership. 2 years after Portland first welcomed scooters, for example, now virtually every major city in North America has them, including Seattle, which rolled out scooters just a month ago. So once again, Portland is the lead. Portland's program has been a national policy leader by introducing measures to encourage safe riding and parking. In addition, we've had seen great partnerships to do even more, like when Lyme and Disability Rights Oregon partnered with PBOT to script, film, and distribute educational videos to help riders to understand why the parking and riding rules that PBOT set matter. The results of these efforts have lowered complaints to organizations like DARO by over 50%. Scooters connect people where other non-car options have been few and far between, and scooter companies do a lot to make that even more accessible. For example, to increase access and usage in East Portland, Lyme has cut our prices by 50% for all trips that begin in the East Portland pattern area. Meanwhile, our low-income program enrollees citywide pay a low Lyme access rate of 7 cents per minute. For context, that's a 70% reduction off our normal price and makes a half-hour, five-mile scooter trip cheaper than a bus ride on TriMet. And those bus rides are heavily government subsidized. Scooters are not. I've had the opportunity to speak to many of our riders across Portland. One of them, a low-income program enrollee, uses our scooters because he doesn't have a car, recently had his bike stolen, and uses the scooters to deliver for DoorDash. He says the scooters are critical because he wouldn't be able to keep his job without them. Or there's Julie, another low-income enrollee who doesn't own a car and doesn't have a nearby TriMet line. She had a medical issue over the past year and meant that she couldn't walk large distances, so scooters have been a lifeline getting her to her downtown job. She also feels good about the carbon footprint of scooters, which our life cycle analysis show are quite similar to a bus on a per rider basis. We've heard today from commenters about the environmental justice issues that result from pollution and excessive car use. We know that PBOT data, scooters reduce car use, but they also reduce car ownership. While our data shows at Lyme that during the first 4 months of COVID, 6% of global households added a car to their household since the pandemic began, mainly due to concerns about transit or reductions in service. PBOT's data shows that scooter riders reduce their car ownership by 7% and another 13% have considered selling. So scooters are a technologically driven, environmentally sustainable solution that is budget neutral for the city to implement. In a time where we must use every tool available to combat climate change, improve roadway safety, make our transportation system more equitable, and give people options during COVID, we believe it makes all the sense in the world for PBOT to continue this world-class program. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Next up, we have Lindsay Murphy.
Hi, Lindsay. Lindsay, are you there? She's unmuted. Keelan, now she's muted.
Yeah, it looks like she might be having trouble with her mute.
Let's see, is she on the, okay, she's dropped off. Oh wait, no, there she is. Lindsay, can you hear us? And do we know, is she on a computer or is she on a phone?
It looks like she's on a computer. She just chatted and said that she can hear us.
She's here. She's on a computer.
We're not able to hear her.
Okay. She's unmuted according to this. She says she's unmuted. Lindsay, let's do this. It sounds like you can hear me. We'll go on to the next speaker and maybe if you could just re-log in. Let's see if that helps.
Or check her volume.
Okay, and she's saying, Keelan, if you provide the call-in number, Marcus is saying you can relay that to her.
Okay, the call-in number is included in the invitation that Lindsay
got it. So she's going to sign back in. She says her volume's on high. Why don't we go ahead and go to the next person? We'll come back to Lindsay.
Okay, great. The next person is, it looks like, Sarah Stambaugh.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you, City Council, for taking the time to hear us speak today. My name's Sarah Stambaugh, and my fiance is Victor Levine, and we are fleet managers for Bird, one of the five sets of fleet managers here in Portland. It's a new program, I think, that Bird has rolled out. We're incredibly excited and grateful for the opportunity to continue to partner with Bird and the City of Portland. We have worked hard to provide and maintain our fleet, which is 100 scooters privately that we own, so that the community can enjoy the scooters, but not only that, that they're not a nuisance to the city and local businesses. So we've done things such as business cards, stopped by local hotels, dropped off cards, and touched base with concierge, letting them know if there's a problem with scooters blocking entrances, to just give us a call. No matter whose they are, we'll come and grab them. We also take time every day to sanitize any bird that's touched for COVID reasons. And then also the other night, for instance, down on Salmon Street, all the scooters, including Bird, Lime, Bolt, and Spins, were knocked completely down on both sides of the street. And Victor picked all of those up and put them upright. So we do that because we feel, you know, one bird down or one scooter down is a scooter down for all of us. Also, as fleet managers, we feel like we didn't really get a fair shot or an opportunity to operate due to the 100 plus days of riots. In fact, we've had to take loans out just to survive like many other small businesses. And we'd be incredibly grateful for the chance and opportunity to operate in 2021.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And can I confirm that you are not registered lobbyists?
I am not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's go back and see if Lindsay is there. Lindsay, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, loud and clear. Excellent.
All right. Well,
with us.
Sure. So hi, Portland City Council. I'm Lindsay Murphy. I'm a resident and small business owner based in Northwest Portland. And I'm personally committed to the mission of access, inclusion, and representation in education, STEM, and also transportation. I couldn't be in more support of the permanent fixture of e-scooters as a micro-mobility public transportation option. They are safe, they are fun, they're environmentally friendly when done right, and they are economical, or at least they can be. So I intentionally live a low emissions lifestyle. I don't have a car, I've never had a car. And personally, I am scared to death of riding a bike. It might be a center of gravity thing, I don't really know. And a major reason that I moved to Portland back in 2013 is because of the incredible public transportation system. And so in 2018, when they started littering our streets with these super fun little devices called e-scooters, I was overjoyed to have an option other than Ubering, which can be very expensive, and public transit, which for me, I'm late all the time, so I'm always missing the bus. So being able to hop on one is incredibly convenient and at the time, economical. You know, to talk about the environmental aspect of e-scooters, they are factually a zero tailpipe emission device. And the environmental concerns that are around e-scooters, are centered on how they're made and what they're made of. And that's not dissimilar to the historic and current industry standards for motor vehicles, motorcycles, and children's toys. And you know, if you pop into your local grocery store, everything is wrapped in plastic. So plastic, materials, production, disposal, those are issues that we are working through as a local and global community. And I see the answer for e-scooters, like all things, in the development and continued innovation and in material development, sourcing, production, manufacturing, distribution, and disposal industries. They are safe. To say, there was a study that was published back in February of this year by the International Transportation Forum that found that e-scooters are either as safe or safer than bicycles, motorized mopeds, and motorcycles. And while there's not enough data from hospitals and emergency response departments, even the provisional conclusions put e-scooter visits to emergency departments on par with mopeds and cyclists, and significantly lower than cars and motorcyclists. You know, and like the notes that were previously mentioned in testimonies and speakers prior about drones and the scooters themselves, safety improves over time. I actually have a graph that I'll happily send along to whoever would be interested in seeing it that shows that over time, over literally a 12-month period of increased ridership, safety issues go down. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Next, we have Philip Wolf.
Keelan.
All right. So it looks like I'm going to. Philip, are you able to unmute? There we go.
Hi, Phil. Are you ready? Philip, it looks like you're sending a chat. Mayor Wheeler, Philip is deaf and has submitted written testimony that I'm going to be reading for him while he signs.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Yeah. As you might see in the chat box, Philip is saying that I'm reading his testimony for him because we were unable to provide an interpreter when Philip signed up for testimony yesterday. We scrambled to try and arrange one, but it was a little bit difficult. So, Philip, are you ready? Are you ready, Philip? Yeah, great. Hello, my name is Philip Wolf. Hello, my name is Philip Wolf, and as an avid scooter user with Hello, my name is Philip Wolf, and as an avid scooter user with my favorite vendor, Lime, I felt the urgency to step in and share some of my thoughts about this matter. When scooters first came to Portland, I was... Is the closed captioning working? I believe he was going to try and track along with my voice.
It is working. The closed captioning is working.
When scooters came to Portland, I was thrilled and... When scooters came to Portland, I was thrilled and tried all the vendors and found Lime to be my vendor of choice for several reasons. Great lighting at night, excellent maintenance service, easy to access to Lime app for services I need, reasonable pricing, and is very accessible. In 2018, I have testified before people with different organizations at PBOT concerning the future of this vendor, what they need to improve, suggestions for how they will map out their future pilot in action and address concerns. I gave a compelling testimony, which inspired many to consider my urgency for Lyme to continue based on my lived experience with using Lyme and living in the Pearl District next to downtown. I was also invited to be one of the panelists at the Street Trust's Oregon Active Transportation Summit held at the Oregon Zoo site. 500 people were there to hear, see panelists' perspective, and I believe that they appreciate my story, which inspired Lyme to do better, and they certainly did. I expressed concerns about people using scooters on sidewalks, which puts people at risk of harm, especially people with disabilities, and yes, myself included. Later on, PBOT then contacted me and asked me to invest in a video in collaborative efforts to send a strong message how important it is for all of us to work together in following guidelines for the sake of our public safety here in Portland. That was last year. To this day, I saw a significant improvement, so I believe that Lyme is committed to continue this work and will do more with my suggestion that they expand with different scooter devices, which would serve people with disabilities, so that this can be more inclusive and provide more options for accessibility here in Portland. There is further discussion with this effort that I am investing in with PBOT and Lyme. I am proud of my contribution and encourage Lyme to offer more, which I believe they will do in time. I'm confident that Lyme has needed data to justify why Lyme is needed. With all that said, please, I urge you to support the continuation of keeping Lyme as one of the funders for the city of Portland. Thank you. Here is a receipt of our work. I implore you all to take 2 minutes to watch this video here produced by Portland Bureau of Transportation, Disability Rights Oregon, Rooted in Rights, and Lyme. And then Philip gave us a link to a website, which I believe the council clerk shared with council this morning.
Thank you. Next individual, please.
Next up, we have Wayne Reiner.
Good morning, Wayne.
Morning, Mayor. Good morning, City Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. As mentioned, my name is Wayne Reiner, and I am not a lobbyist. I'm speaking today to offer you a perspective of someone who is actively involved in the scooter business. I am an independent business owner in partnership with Bird that operates in Portland City Center as well as outlying neighborhoods. My company manages and ensures Bird scooters are available to riders in all areas, including neighborhoods east of the 205. Like Sarah and Victor, who spoke earlier, I'm one of five fleet managers in the Portland area that work with Bird. We are all independent businesses that live, work, and pay taxes in the Portland area. My company, along with the other local fleet managers, have partnered with Bird to assume the responsibilities of all Bird scooter maintenance and management in Portland. Unlike the historic relationships with contractor scooter chargers who simply earn revenue from charging and deploying scooters, we have a business partnership with Bird where our income is based on revenue from ridership. This gives us the opportunity to generate enough revenue to hire W-2 employees and create jobs, us specifically, my company. Bird has a stake in our business and only prospers when we as local entrepreneurs do well. We often meet with Bird for guidance on best practices for scooter management and sanitation processes. We have a vetted interest in ensuring safe ridership is practiced. And while working in the neighborhoods and city center area, we often find ourselves in an educator role with riders, encouraging them to wear helmets and stay off sidewalks. In addition, we find many circumstances where we practice stewardship for other scooter company vehicles. As Sarah was mentioning earlier, Sarah and Victor, we often find ourselves providing maintenance to or moving hazardously parked scooters and picking up knocked over scooters, even for non-bird scooters. Regarding any COVID-19 concerns, we have mandates to ensure our fleets are properly cleaned and safe for riders. This, along with other care, is something that we take on as local business owners. In short, the presence of bird scooters in Portland represents local businesses in action. It also represents the employment of people who earn a living wage. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Wayne.
Next up, we have Mimi German.
Morning.
Hi, and thank you. I have testimony today. I'm trying to find the, there we go. Sorry, it's been a long wait and an interesting listen today. So my testimony today is titled Joe Walsh, A Man with a Scooter and a Message. Joe left his body yesterday. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. I decided that there'd be no better homage to my dear friend than to say his name here at City Council one last time. Joe came to City Council meetings to listen, and while he hoped the commissioners would do the right thing for the residents of Portland, he knew better. He witnessed corrupt terrorist gangs of thugs, aka the police, and their police chiefs over the years murdering people in our Black community. Yet he came. He came to City Council on his scooter. He witnessed your gang of terrorist cops murdering our most vulnerable, our houseless neighbors, who the city has continued to turn a blind eye to with ample amounts of lip service. Joe knew that the only way to pave the way to justice for Portlanders was to come here, to City Council, most recently, on his scooter, to hold each of the city commissioners, the mayor, and the police chief accountable for the atrocities that you all have unleashed upon us. Joe knew, as I do, and as other city council protesters know, that you give a no questions asked carte blanche check to developers while displacing our houseless friends on the street, leaving them to their despair and the terror of the cops and rapid response who sweep them daily. Joe came to make yay votes turn into no votes. Joe came to hold you accountable and you threw him out time and time again. Now he's gone. Because he told the truth, because he held the mirror of justice and humanity in your faces so that you could see yourselves and the destruction you have caused, you threw him out. Joe, even on his scooter, just wanted you to listen, to appeal to your own humanity, to the height of humanity, not just its base, but you threw him out. This is who you are. In honor of Joe's lifelong sacrifice, in honor of Joe coming down here relentlessly, tirelessly, week after week for decades, with enough oxygen in his tank to get here and get home, I honor his work, I honor his life, I honor his outrage, I honor his commitment to truth and his understanding of law and justice. I honor his view and perspective as it pertained to you. Joe called you out. Joe put you up to the task. Joe gave a damn. Joe was beautiful. Portland beautiful. May the memory of Joe Walsh remind you to do better, to learn what love looks like and what love truly is and what you are doing, and that what you are doing is not even close. Our outrage will continue in Joe's name and in the names of all who have been brutalized and murdered by your cops, by your failed policies, by your lack of care, by your insincerity, by your lack of humility, by your hubris for the next dollar, for the next vote. I love you, Joe Walsh. I will miss you. May your name ring out in Portland City Council chambers forever in the name of justice. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next individual, please.
The last person we have is Marcus Mundy.
Hey, Marcus. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor. Good morning, Council. My name is Marcus Mundy, and I am, of all things, a registered lobbyist for CCC with the City of Portland. But more importantly, I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Communities of Color, a 19-member organization of culturally specific nonprofit entities performing essential services for people of color throughout Portland, our region, and the state of Oregon.
I'll come find you.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on agenda item 811 related to e-scooters. I am speaking in favor of making the e-scooter program permanent as a tool to provide more equitable, emission-free mobility options to our entire city. Additionally, we're asking that the program be expanded in size so that all corners of the city can be served with these options. Mobility and accessing our community without having to use a car is an equity and sustainability issue. Scooters provide a critical alternative for people who don't have easy access to a TriMet route that serves their trip type. In many cases, TriMet routes are not near them, don't serve the trip needs of all users, and scooters can help solve that. Portland's communities of color are transportation challenged and they need options. Scooters also help thousands get transportation at a cost cheaper than public transit. For those that are involved in low-income programs, they tell us that it gives them a convenient option that saves them money. These options may go away if scooters don't continue to be available in Portland. As you know, CCC supports equity-minded transportation measures, such as Metro's 26218, that benefit the BIPOC communities of Portland. E-scooters are one such option. These options are critical to closing transportation gaps that exist in our city. In fact, we can use them to close even more gaps. We should be ensuring enough scooters are in our city to serve low-income users throughout the city, in addition to downtown Lloyd District and East Portland. In fact, trips beginning in East Portland can be half the price of trips starting elsewhere in the city and better serve the BIPOC communities of Portland who tend to live there. We hope that the council will continue this nation-leading program providing more environmentally friendly, low-cost transportation options. Thanks for your time today, and it's good to hear all of you commissioners today. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Mendy. And as always, we appreciate the many issues that you work with us on from a community perspective. Your input is invaluable. The input of your organization is invaluable, and I appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Next individual, please, Keelan.
That's all.
Very good. All right, colleagues, are there any further questions before we go to the roll call? I'm not seeing any. Keelan, please call the roll. This is a resolution. I'm sorry. It's a report. Sorry, I need a motion in a second.
So moved.
Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner. I'm actually showing this as a resolution.
Oh, I should never question my good judgment. This is a resolution. Please call the roll.
New Daly.
Well, first of all, thank you to the PBOT team. Thank you to everyone who gave testimony and to my colleagues for the great conversation. I've gone from being highly skeptical of e-scooters to being really excited about the potential for us to do even better. In particular, my ears perked up when a testifier mentioned that delivery drivers are using e-scooters. So I've already let my staff know that I'm interested in creating a discounted program for them, for e-scooters and e-bikes, working with the platforms and giving them extra education and support so that they can model good rider behavior. We can reduce the number of cars on the road, save them some money, and support workers who are really essential to us right now, but who are very precarious working in the gig economy. So keep your ears open for that. I also want to appreciate the contractors that came to testify today. I know this is an incredibly hard time for our small businesses and local economy. I do want to emphasize that the biggest impact is coming from COVID. And I just want to urge people to be careful about their language when talking about the protests. We haven't had 100 plus days of riots. That's a narrative being advanced by Fox News and the federal administration. We have had 100 days of largely peaceful protests with a very small minority of protesters committing acts of violence and vandalism. There's a big difference between a civil disturbance and a riot. And these protests are against police violence in support of Black lives and have made a big difference locally and nationally. So I don't want to hear them mischaracterized. I don't want them to be dismissed. I don't want the focus to be taken away from the cause. And that being said, the council needs to work with community, continue to work with community to support our small businesses through the multiple crises that we're dealing with. So again, I want to thank the staff who've worked hard on this report, previous reports, and the entire e-scooter program. In particular, thank you to Jacob Sherman, Love Johnson, and Catherine. Oh, Catherine, I still trip on your last name, Chiarlo. Will you say it for me?
That was perfect.
It was? Oh, yeah. Good. Okay. I mean, I have to relinquish my Italian card for that. So thank you, Catherine, for your work and presentation today. I appreciate the report's recommendation to create a permanent e-scooter program, and we'll be working with community stakeholders on implementation as we change how e-scooters are managed by PBOT. And finally, I just want to extend my condolences and sympathy to the friends, family, and community of Joe Walsh, who, as we know, was a passionate advocate and a vocal critic of City Council. We certainly didn't always agree, but I know that he will be missed. And thank you, Mimi, for your testimony and bringing that to our attention. I vote aye.
Ryan.
Yes, first of all, thank you so much for PBOT for your very informative presentation and the community for your testimony. This e-scooter testing implementation has come a long way in 2 years. It's really obvious. I'm also grateful for everything that PBOT has done to research the issue of e-scooters in our city. And I'm really appreciative of the intention by which you approach the new contracts. Also, I'm really proud that we're a leader of this inevitable mobility choice on the world stage. I firmly believe that we have to continuously work to provide as many transportation options for Portlanders as possible, especially as so many are impacted by the economic downturn, coupled with the climate crisis that we're currently facing. And I appreciate the remarks by the small businesses. E-scooters can and should be part of the pathway to creating a more equitable transportation system in the City Roses, and I do vote aye.
Hardesty?
I want to once again really appreciate PBOT staff. From my first week at City Hall, I've had lots of very informative briefings and conversations around improving transportation access to people in the city of Portland, with a special focus on East Portland, which is my home. I want to caution PBOT that as they continue to gather data, I do need that data disaggregated because it's not helpful when we just say BIPOC to know who, what communities are really getting the opportunity for these diverse transportation options. I want to appreciate Mimi for being here and also give my condolences to friends and family of Joe Walsh. He and I have been buddies, and then once he called me a cocktail liberal, and we made up, and may he rest in power for the passion that he brought to advocacy. Around this project, I would hope that if employment opportunities are being made, that we're able to see BIPOC people in those employment opportunities, if they're local employments that are leading to living wage jobs. I would like to see the data about how we are advancing our equity goals all the way around, not just who gets to use the transportation option, but who gets to work for the transportation option. We can't just look at equity at the back end. We have to look at it every way through this contract. And so I hope the next conversation, we can really disaggregate that data to find out really who does benefit when these companies get these city contracts, and whether or not we are ensuring that we're not just saying that we're centering BIPOC communities, but we actually are centering BIPOC communities. I also want to just reinforce something Commissioner Udaly said, It was hard to hold my tongue when I hear businesses misrepresenting 120 plus days of protests as a riot, because again, one day we had a riot and we've not had a riot since then. We have a lot of racial healing that we need to do as a community, and we cannot do it if people are mischaracterizing what is happening on our streets. And I would encourage people to be very thoughtful about spreading misinformation. I'm happy to vote aye. I look forward to the next steps.
Wheeler.
I want to thank Commissioner Udaly, and I want to thank the PBOT team for their hard work on this and really the tremendous due diligence that they've put into this, the gathering of information, the sharing of information, the community outreach that they've undertaken, and bringing back what's a very, very solid report. I do support the program. I support the frame that PBOT has used in terms of accessibility, making sure that we're being both geographical as well as thoughtful about accessibility issues. And I have a couple of, one is a thought and one is a concern that I hope we'll address going forward. First, the thought. We will decide collectively as a community what the culture around scooters is going to be. And in some communities, the culture is one of indifference, where people dump the scooters on a sidewalk, they block ADA ramps, they block the doors to businesses and households. Pretty much once they get off the scooter, they see it as a disposable object and therefore somebody else's problem. That's one culture. The other culture is the one that we are trying to cultivate here, which is one of courtesy, and understanding that if you leave a scooter in the middle of the sidewalk, there are people who may not see it. There are older folks who might not note that it is there. It's a trip hazard. It's a trip and fall hazard. It's a blockage. It's not the way it's intended to be. So that's going to require outreach on our part. It's going to be about public messaging. It's going to be about encouraging the appropriate use of scooters. They're a valuable tool when used correctly, and when used incorrectly, it's sidewalk junk and it's in the way and it makes people really angry. So let's commit collectively as a council right here and now that if we're gonna move forward on this program, we're gonna work with our private sector providers to make sure that we fully inform people about the opportunities, about the risks, that we help create that culture of both safety on one hand, encouraging people to use helmets, discouraging underage use, and on the other hand, encouraging common decency and courtesy about where to leave them when people are done using them. So that's my comment. My concern continues to hinge around liability. And I understand when we're talking about a really good last mile option, when we're talking about an equitable and accessible option, sometimes it feels a little stodgy to be talking about liability, but there is significant liability associated with this program. Number one, we are providing access to it. Number two, we already know that compliance with the rules around the age of use as well as wearing helmets is poorly adhered to by the public. And I want clarity from our service providers that they understand the risks, that they are taking on the vast majority, if not all, of the implicit liability in these issues, that we make sure that the user agreements are very ironclad in terms of the users on liability with respect to using these tools, should they voluntarily choose to do so. But I do not believe it's appropriate for the taxpayers to take on the liability that should otherwise go to the providers of these services. So that's my concern. And I know that people at PBOT and our legal department understand that. I know that our service providers have heard my concerns in this regard, and I hope that they'll continue to work with us on these issues as well. But on the whole, this is a great program. It's been well received. It's been very well managed by PBOT in the City of Portland. Commissioner Udaly, I want to congratulate you on getting this program to the place where it is today. I'm happy to vote aye. The resolution is adopted. Thank you all. Thanks to everybody who testified. We now move on to the regular agenda. Next up is item 816. If you could read 816 and 817 together, please, Keelan.
Of course. Update loss control and prevention code to streamline coordination and implementation of citywide loss prevention activities and remove the loss control and prevention advisory committee. 817, amend administrative policy, loss prevention policy, to streamline Bureau loss prevention plan procedures and implementation.
Colleagues, these two legislative items will amend the administrative policies on loss control and prevention codes. The proposed amendment provides additional clarity, streamlines processes, reflects organizational change, and aligns with loss prevention and safety industry best practices and regulatory requirements. This ordinance updates language. However, it does not change the existing requirement that bureaus develop a loss prevention plan, and the proposed amendments do not change the existing requirements to address loss prevention. We're going to now hear more from our presenter, Patrick Hughes. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler, and thank you, commissioners. Can you see my video?
We can see you.
Okay, good, because I'm not used to Zoom, so I can't see myself.
You look great. You look great.
Okay. I'll give you a quick minute of history that tries to explain the scenario that we're in, the reasons for the changes to both the policy and the administrative rule are appropriate this time. Now, a key factor to consider is that the city is self-insured for workers' compensation. To maintain that designation, we basically have to follow Oregon OSHA self-insured rules to meet loss prevention efforts. So there's a key regulatory factor behind this policy that you may or may not have known about. The current policy was developed in 84, 86, and 2008. It has not been updated since 2008. The changes that we have discussed and presented show that longstanding, I guess, just continuation of an ongoing policy that hasn't actually been enforced to a degree. The administrative rule was developed in 96 and has not been reviewed or updated since 96. So again, we have a stale document. The big situation with both the rule and the policy, there are notations of existing committees. The Loss Prevention Advisory Committee is noted in chapter 354. It actually has the mayor, the commissioner, auditor, city attorney, and director of Office of Fiscal Administration, and the personnel director. You may be aware, because you haven't been on the committee, that it hasn't met in over 10 years. A similar committee existed on the safety net and the administrative rule and policy 11.01. That was identified as the safety net team. That also has not met within 10 years. A couple of these items in conjunction with increasing loss prevention across the city basically require that we go through with update with both the policy and the rule. Regulatory-wise, OSHA is now viewing the city as one entity, not bureau by bureau. OSHA has been in the city in the past 7 months and have created three significant inspections. They have all talked about looking at the city as an entity and not bureau by bureau. Thus, the policy and the administrative rule become even more important to create a citywide aspect for loss prevention efforts. The work to get to the point where you are now seeing the amended policy and the rule involve working in collaboration with all bureaus. They all had representatives with a risk management loss prevention team, including city attorney. They had three large work group meetings in the fall of 2009. We're now getting close to 2021, but COVID has delayed us being able to present here. All bureaus had broad buy-in and support of the documents that are in your possession, which is very good news. Proposed changes for the policy, the key thing on the changes becomes omitting that committee that has just not been active. We probably should not have that in black and white because we are failing our own policies at that point. The administrative rule is more of the meat and potatoes working document. That took out, of course, the safety net committee, which I mentioned. It clarified roles and accounted for organizational changes, removed benchmarks that were imposed upon bureaus. And the reason for that was the benchmarks were based on injury and illness rates. And if you look at it in one direction, that could actually deter reporting and working on employee solutions. And beyond that, we took out a specific role for the Bureau Safety Committees. What we are going to do within the policy is creating, within the administrative rule, is going forward, create a new committee called the Loss Prevention Committee. That'll be with Bureau representatives and the risk management loss prevention team to look more at an overall city view and actually attack the things that we see. I'll talk a little bit about the direction in general. Once, if this gets passed through, risk management has provided a template called the loss prevention template that will be allowed for every bureau to actually go through a format to quickly create their own loss prevention template plan. That document thus ensures that every bureau has this, which is an OSHA requirement. Risk management will be assisting with it, training on it, and reviewing and accepting those. Thus, at any moment and any time, any bureau looking at an OSHA inspection will be able to say, here is our loss prevention plan. That qualification gets checked off. They will be able to designate, each bureau being they, can designate their current and intended loss prevention efforts. OSHA identifies 10 categories. They will be able to pick and choose from that. And that will be their plan of action for that year. Annually, risk management loss prevention will be reviewing that and updating that. So those are the key factors that I know I'm spinning through that. And I know that I'm probably more in tune with what OSHA requires, what we have to do to stay within regulatory compliance, as well as the safety efforts across the city. Safety, I've heard all morning, is coming from many different directions.
Hey Patrick, before we move to this next section, let's get a question in here from Commissioner Hardesty.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Patrick. What was the work that was not done for 10 years by the two advisory committees, and where does that work take place now?
I am uncertain of the work that they did. I was not here at that time, and the committees have fell off for a decade, so it's hard to even tell what the intention was. My guess would be to standardize discussions at a city level of what is happening with both loss prevention and safety. So I think that's been slowly replaced by, of course, risk management is tracking all of the workers' compensation claims and the incidents. So I imagine they were probably discussing somewhat data like that and trying to identify hot spots within the city that needed attention for loss prevention.
And I'm sorry to be asking you questions before your time and before my time, but I'm curious as to whether there was outside participation anticipated on these committees, and if so, how does the community's voice feed into the work of safety and risk management?
The listed members in the existing policy do not include anyone from outside of the city, which may feel appropriate to some degree because loss prevention is really key directly toward employee safety.
Right.
So.
And one last question. Are we going to get an unrealistic perspective of safety if we are being graded as a city as compared to bureau by bureau? You know, some bureaus use computers a lot more than others, and some bureaus have weapons that have the potential to cause harm. And so if we're being collectively graded, what would that process look like? And what's the advantage and disadvantage of doing it as a combined group?
The intent of OSHA when focusing on the city as a whole instead of bureau by bureau, that intent is not to grade each bureau against the city. The intent is that the city and its leadership are taking safety and loss prevention in the highest level and pushing that downwards. So bureau by bureau, they will have, there's many different, you have the office setting versus PBOT, and all of those things will be different. Thus, loss prevention efforts and their loss prevention plan for PBOT is extremely different than, say, OMF, which is probably 90% office work.
Right.
But the grading, there's not a grading by OSHA. It's OSHA is intending to say someone at the high level of the city is making sure that actually every bureau is being compliant with their requirements.
All right. That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay.
Any other questions right there?
Colleagues, anything else? All right. Patrick, did you have more in your presentation?
The only thing that I wanted to say is in the big picture, and we're already there, so it's not a deficiency, but the update of these policies and the rule will really assist in us looking at saying risk management will be able to consult more directly and efficiently with each bureau on safety topics. We will slowly be moving in a positive direction to standardize the city's loss prevention techniques and efforts. And we will be able to now individually through the bureaus and thus for the whole city document appropriately to Oregon OSHA, you know, when they come and for any reason that we are on track to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Good presentation. I appreciate it. And you excelled at Zoom. So well done. Well done. Welcome to the new world. With that, colleagues, any further questions before we open this up for public testimony? Seeing a couple of head shakes. No. Keelan, do we have anybody signed up for 810 or 811?
No one is on the line to testify for those items.
All right. Very good, Patrick. Great work. These 810 is the first reading of the non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. And same with, oh no, I totally got the numbers wrong here. 816 is the first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. And 817 is also a non-emergency ordinance. It also moves to second reading. And we now have had Commissioner Fritz with us for quite a while, and I just want to point that out. We can go ahead and read 818, please.
Authorize price agreement for pump station improvements for professional engineering design services for a total not to exceed amount of $15 million.
Commissioner Fritz.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for letting me go to the Oregon League of Oregon Cities Convention, which is where I was this morning. So this is the Environmental Services operates nearly 100 pump stations that work together with over 2,000 miles of pipes to direct sewage and stormwater to the Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant. Environmental Services has a need to keep the pump stations working reliably in order to prevent sewage overflows and to protect public health and the environment. This ordinance would authorize BES to issue a request for proposals and award 3 5-year contracts of $5 million each so that BES can more efficiently and effectively deliver pump station improvements and increase their resilience and reliability. Here today with a brief presentation are Aaron Lawler, Senior Engineer, and Paul Suto, Engineering Manager, both from the Bureau of Environmental Services.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. For the record, I'm Paul Suto, Engineering Manager with BES. And as Commissioner Fritz noted in the introduction, we're here today to request approval for what we believe is a more efficient way to contract with our engineering consulting firms to deliver the critical work for the sewage pump stations for the city so we can maintain our service levels for the community. So the goal is for us to be more timely in addressing the rehab needs to better serve the community. So I'll hand it off to Aaron Lawler now, and I'll be available for any questions as needed. Thank you.
Hello, thank you, commissioners, mayor, for having me today. I just want to check real quick. Are you just seeing my presentation slides or are you seeing my entire screen? Yeah, great. Thank you. let's see if we can. So what you see here on the slide is what I refer to as the pump station subway map, which is a high level overview of the pump station system that the city operates. As mentioned earlier, the Bureau of Environmental Services owns and operates nearly 100 sewage pump stations for the purpose of collecting and conveying City of Portland wastewater and a portion of the stormwater. In 2019, the Treatment and Pumping Systems Division, which goes by the acronym TPSD, teamed up with the Asset Systems Management Group to complete the Pump Station System Plan. The purpose of the plan was to develop a data-driven risk analysis process that would aid in allocating funding for the pump station improvements. Recommendations from the plan include increasing the investment rate and the rate of project delivery based on the current condition of the pump station assets. This legislation is intended to expedite further evaluation, condition assessment, prioritization, and project delivery of pump station improvement projects over the next 5 years. This approach will increase our ability to protect human health and safety and the environment, as well as continue to meet regulatory requirements. Hopefully this is a familiar building to you all. It's Ankeny Pump Station located on the waterfront near where Saturday Market is. The purpose of this legislation is to authorize the creation of a price agreement for pump station improvements. With the three highest scoring proposers from a competitive solicitation for engineering design services. While ordinances are not required prior to solicitation and negotiation of professional, technical, and expert services, BES and Procurement Services agreed that it would be appropriate to request council approval prior to solicitation based on the total value of the price agreement. The current RFP, request for proposal, process typically requires a minimum of 1 year to complete, applies to individual projects, and includes all phases of the project under one contract. The intent of this price agreement for pump station improvements is to pre-qualify three consultants through one RFP and to allow this price agreement to be used on a number of different pump stations improvement projects. Consultant selection will be conducted in accordance with Chapter 5.68 of the Portland City Code. The total not to exceed amount of the on-call engineering design services price agreements is $15 million for a period of 5 years, distributed evenly over three price agreements. Utilization of price agreements will increase project delivery efficiency and program flexibility for delivery of pump station projects. This approach will allow us to deliver the design and construction for approximately 9 to 15 pump station upgrade projects through one request for proposal. Whereas with current contracting methods, this would require a request for a proposal for each project, creating additional work for BES staff, as well as extending delivery duration. Next slide here. This right here is a demonstration of the type of pump station upgrades that we do. This is Alder Pump Station located near the Morrison Bridge. The site on the left here is the original pump station, and this is a nearly completed upgrade of the pump station. This price agreement would provide for flexibility and effectiveness to meet the needs of our aging pump stations. Projects to be completed under this price agreement would range from major pump station upgrades, construction of new pump stations already identified in the capital improvement program, equipment replacement, seismic improvement projects, in response to emergency projects similar to what we discussed. In drafting the price agreement, we often identified numerous projects that were recently completed or are currently in progress that would have been great candidates for this approach had it been an option. We would have used this price agreement to leverage the flexibility and efficiency that this price agreement will provide. The price agreements will be funded over the 5 year period through the annual appropriations. Funds are available in the sewer system operating fund for these price agreements. Work performed under these price agreements will be authorized via written task orders. Each negotiated price agreement shall include the participation of disadvantaged, minority, women, emerging small business, or service disabled veteran owned business enterprises. The aspirational participation goal for this DMW ESB SD VBE utilization is 34%, and all consultants shall commit to making good faith effort towards achieving the goal. And that concludes our presentation. I'm open up for questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty.
Let me stop sharing my screen real quick.
I know, don't stop sharing it yet. Would you go back one slide, please?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that very efficient presentation. So my question about this aspirational goal of 34%, based on the material that you submitted, there was not high utilization of subcontractors in your initial approach to primary contractors. And so now you're going to put into a contract, or your proposal to put into three different contracts, a 34% utilization. What we know based on the last two audits of our procurement efforts is that we do a really good job of getting contracts into the hands of white men, and not a good job at all of getting contracts into the hand of other people who are part of that alphabet soup. Why would we support this without a clear plan to make sure that this will be the most diverse contracting pool that we could expect here at the city?
Correct. So just a quick clarification on what you were referencing. This is the first time we have headed to council for this program. I think maybe you are referencing the on-call construction program that was brought to you earlier this year. Is that what you were referring to?
I'm actually referring to the City of Portland's history of having the alphabet soup, but the outcomes being that white men primarily benefit from those opportunities.
Correct. So, I mean, we will emphasize to our proposing consultants that the city would like to focus on subconsultant firms owned by people of color. And that can be explicit in the RFP. However, we did reach out to our procurement group to understand what options are available to us to ensure that there is more participation by people of color, businesses that are minority owned. And what we were told is that providing more points or a better score for certain certification types would not be considered race neutral, since we do not have a disparity study that supports the legal defense of setting hard goals on this approach. And so we aren't really able to guarantee in this way through current contracting methods. Paul, please feel free to add more if you have anything.
Let me just say that we're never going to change the outcomes if we're not thinking creatively about how we make those opportunities available. That's not a really good enough answer for me. If you want to be able to do three separate contracts and you can't actually guarantee that we're going to contract a bit differently than we have in the past, aspirations are fine, but that aspirations don't feed people or build businesses in our community.
Understood.
Yeah, I appreciate that point, Commissioner Hardesty. One thing I can just add is based on what the outreach we did with procurement, I guess the only tool, so to speak, that we have at this point to change anything is be more explicit to our consulting engineering community on the value of having minority subconsultant firms versus the white-owned subconsultant firms. There. So it's more of, where in the past we haven't been that explicit. We've just given kind of like our standard language of aspirational goals for the DMWSB program overarching, but we can at least make it clear that this is important to the city and the long-term success of the city, and it's important to us. So that's, at this point, that seems like the best we can do given the current structure of contracting in the city.
I appreciate that, but I think we have to think creatively. If we continue to say these are the outcomes we want, and then every audit tells us we're not even close to getting the outcomes we want, then we can't keep contracting the way we've always contracted. I'm really open to innovation about how do we make sure we get the goal that we want rather than just putting it as an aspiration in a contract.
That has never worked for the city of Portland, right? And if it works, it works accidentally. But I am very concerned that we continue to say that we are centering equity, and actually at the end of the day, we really aren't. We're just doing what we've always done. Thank you.
Any further questions? Public testimony, Keelan?
No one has signed up.
All right, this is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you for the presentation. 819 is the second reading. Can you read that, Keelan?
Update drainage and water quality code provisions to facilitate the implementation of the stormwater management manual and the source control manual.
Colleagues, this is the second reading of a non-emergency ordinance. We've already heard a presentation. There's been opportunities for public testimony. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
I realize I'm the only one that's fired up about this, but I'm fired up about it. It's really good. Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
It's okay to be fired up, Commissioner Fritz. Aye.
Wheeler.
You fire up my friend, Commissioner Fritz. You fired me up. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Last item, 820, please.
Direct city attorney to represent the city in litigation involving campaign finance regulations.
Colleagues, thank you. Before we hear from the city attorney and the city auditor on this item, I want to note my own personal involvement in the question. My campaign is the plaintiff in this lawsuit discussed in the resolution. I'm the city mayor directly supervising the office of the city attorney because in some ways I'm on both sides of this lawsuit, and in order to avoid any appearance of conflict of interest, I'm recusing myself from both the deliberation and the vote on this item. And in fact, since it is the last item this morning, I'm going to turn the gavel over to the council president, Commissioner Fritz, and I'm going to say farewell. So I'll see you all soon. Commissioner Fritz, you are now
the presiding officer.
Yes.
I am also going to recuse myself because I'm in an active campaign and the outcome of this matter could impact me, so I will be leaving as well.
Very good. Commissioner Fritz, you are now presiding officer. I'm turning it over to you. And goodbye.
Thank you, colleagues. Hope the rest of your day goes well. Madam Auditor.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I am here today to bring a legal problem to your attention that my office does not have the capacity, resources, or responsibility to resolve. And a critical court deadline is looming that leaves little time for deliberation. That's why I'm asking that you adopt the proposed resolution directing the city attorney to continue to represent the city in litigation stemming from campaign regulations enforced by the city elections office. Alternatively, I'm asking that you alleviate the city attorney's belief that it is a legal conflict of interest for her to represent the city when the campaign for an elected official or other candidate for office sues her client over a regulatory action taken by the city. This is a complicated issue that will benefit from some background, so let me back up a few steps in the chronology. The city charter assigns a handful of administrative responsibilities to the auditor's office that staff carry out on behalf of the city. For example, the council clerk ensures that council business is scheduled and recorded appropriately. The city archivist promotes the appropriate retention of our official records and ensures public access to them. The elections office is also an administrative responsibility assigned in charter to the auditor's office. Elections office staff determine whether candidates and publicly initiated positions are eligible for the ballot and coordinate with their Multnomah County counterparts on related elections matters, such as they did by putting certified election results on your meeting agenda before Commissioner Ryan could take his seat a few weeks ago. Over the years, the city attorney's office has advised elections office staff through procedural constitutional questions for petitions, ballot title challenges, and more mundane matters. It employs attorneys who are election law experts, and its litigators provide ongoing representation for the city in elections-related disputes as a matter of routine. All of that apparently changed 2 weeks ago when the city attorney informed me that her office would not represent the city in a recently filed lawsuit stemming from new campaign regulations that the elections office staff enforce. Voters approved those regulations by amending city charter in 2018 to limit campaign contributions and expenditures and other financing methods. The amendments were placed on the ballot by initiative petition, and the community members who drafted them assigned my office the duty to investigate complaints and impose fines for violations. Even though voters approved the amendments, the city's position was that several of them, including limits on campaign contributions and expenditures, violated both the state and U.S. constitutions. For that reason, council approved the filing of a validation action that followed behind a similar case from Multnomah County to have a circuit court judge rule on the constitutionality questions. The trial judge struck down some sections of the charter as unconstitutional, including the contribution and expenditure limits. The Multnomah County case was appealed and later taken up by the Oregon Supreme Court. In the meantime, charter amendments as approved by voters were set to go into effect for the city in September of 2019. And the elections office started receiving complaints alleging some campaigns had accepted donations in excess of the $500 limit. The elections office relied on legal advice from the city attorney's office to dismiss those complaints because the trial court had struck down the limits and the matter was pending appeal. Less than a month before the primary election, the Oregon Supreme Court overturned a lower court's decision, setting a new precedent by ruling that the campaign contribution limits did not violate the state constitution. The deputy city attorneys who litigated the matter and advised elections office staff and me through the 18-month court process were instrumental in helping us decide which sections the city could legally enforce and when to begin enforcing them. We began enforcing the contribution limits on May 4th, about 2 weeks before the primary election. Since then, the elections office has received and investigated about 60 complaints against at least 10 campaign committees. Fines have been imposed on some of them and several donors, many of whom were dismayed to learn about the charter regulations, the penalty amounts involved, and how little discretion the elections office has in imposing a rigid formula of fines. By my count, the city has so far been sued 5 times for decisions related to the campaign regulations. The city attorney's office has advised us and litigated on behalf of the city every step of the way until a few weeks ago when one particular lawsuit was filed, Friends of Ted Wheeler versus Mary Hall Caballero. The city attorney informed me in a memo that the decision to decline to represent my office, even though it was acting in its official capacity, was based on an ethical rule for attorneys that prohibits representation when there is a conflict of interest between current clients. I understand that the city attorney may be uncomfortable defending the city in a lawsuit brought by the mayor's campaign committee, given that the mayor oversees the city attorney's office. But the mayor's campaign committee is not the city attorney's client. A private law firm represents his committee. It is the city at this late hour that is without legal representation, even though the city attorney's office advised elections staff up to the point of being sued. Discomfort does not a conflict of interest make. If anything, the city attorney's refusal to represent the city in the lawsuit where the mayor's campaign is the plaintiff is where the real problems arise. Her decision creates the appearance of favoritism of a particular candidate, introduces inconsistent representation of the city across lawsuits raising similar legal issues, and costs money to hire outside counsel during a time when public dollars are desperately needed elsewhere. It also makes no sense for the city attorney to claim a last-minute conflict after advising my office through the investigation and decision-making process in Friends of Ted Wheeler and other cases that resulted in litigation, including one involving the mayor's opponent, Friends of Sarah for Portland. I am at a loss to understand why the city attorney is willing to represent the city in all other cases which involve complaints against friends of Ted Wheeler, but not one in which friends of Ted Wheeler sues the city. The problem is not likely to be a one-off occurrence. If any of you are running for office and your campaign committee breaks the rules, the charter requires me on behalf of the city to fine the campaign committees. That is my job, no matter what discomfort it may involve. If the campaign committee disagrees with the fine, it is welcome to dispute the city's action in court. A court's ruling on these lawsuits will allow the city to gain some clarity about the application of the campaign regulations, which have been difficult to implement given the timing of legal decisions late in the elections process and vague wording in the text that makes interpretation challenging. And whether a lawsuit is brought by one of your campaign committees or the committee of a candidate polling in ninth place or a contributor or a complainant upset over a decision to not investigate or impose a fine, the expectation should be that the city attorney's office defends the city's decision. That's the city attorney's job. The resolution that is before you today makes clear that it is in the city's and the public's interest to have consistent and cost-effective representation in all litigation involving the city's administration of the campaign regulations. It should also alleviate the city's concerns about a conflict of interest. Because the city must file a response to Friends of Ted Wheeler, Friends for Ted Wheeler lawsuit soon, circumstances require prompt direction from you to the city attorney. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Any questions, colleagues?
I have a question, Madam Chairwoman. Is this not an issue that you knew about a month ago? And why did you not take action then?
Did I learn about it a month ago? I learned about it 2 weeks ago.
My understanding is that the city attorney has been working with you, assisting you around this issue. And this issue, this concern came up about a month ago. And now you have this timeline, which is why we are now here at council discussing this.
The city attorney's memo is dated September 29th, 2020.
That's when she wrote the memo. That is true. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question has not been answered, but I'm okay.
I noticed that Tracy Reeve is on the call. Tracy, did you want to say anything?
Sorry, I was having a little difficulty unmuting, and I don't know if my video is working. But so thank you, Commissioner Fritz and council members, and I apologize that my video is not working.
Fine, Tracy.
Oh, okay, good. I just can't see it. So we have represented the auditor's office in all matters pertaining to the campaign finance reform, except for one piece of litigation. We initially had some conversations with the auditor about this potential for a conflict of interest months and months ago, when an issue came up with regard to the Sam Adams campaign. And at that time, we informed her that we were concerned about the ethical issues. She asked that we please take another look at it and see if we could continue representation. Our philosophy in our office is to do as much of the city's legal work in-house as we possibly can for the reasons that the auditor has identified. We think we're the experts on doing the city's legal work, and we think it's more cost-effective for the city. However, the auditor had some time ago, a couple years ago, expressed concerns that she felt that our role could give rise to conflict of interest situations. That was one of the reasons she wanted independent legal counsel at the time that she did the charter reforms. So I believe we met with the auditor and our legal counsel some months ago to discuss these complex issues around these election law matters. We then went back and took a look to see what was the absolute most representation we felt that we could ethically do. And so where we have ended up drawing the line is that we think it is not appropriate for us. We think we have a conflict of interest to represent the auditor in matters involving currently the campaigns of currently sitting city council members. And let me briefly explain how we came to that conclusion. And that is the line that we think permits us to undertake the absolute most possible representation for the auditor's office, while at the same time not violating our ethical obligations under both state law and the legal rules of ethics. So the Oregon Rules of Professional Conduct are the ethical rules governing lawyers. And what is at stake if we violate those are our law license. If lawyers violate the ethical rules, they can be subject to discipline up to and including disbarment or revocation of their law license. The rule that governs conflicts of interest is the Oregon Rule of Professional Conduct 1.7A2, which states that a conflict exists if there's a significant risk that representation of one client will be materially limited by our representation to another client. And here the concern is either that this could negatively impact our representation of the mayor in this particular instance, or our representation of the auditor. Either way, it's a conflict. Now, we have determined that general advice work on elections matters does not meet that threshold of a conflict of interest because it doesn't create a significant risk that our representation will be materially limited. We believe litigation is different. It raises the level of adversity significantly, and then we really do have two adverse parties. Where that is a sitting council member whose campaign is involved in direct litigation with the auditor, we believe that crosses the line and creates a significant risk that our representation of the current city council member could be materially limited, or that our representation of the auditor could be. In particular, we're concerned that when we are actively engaged in litigation against a city council member's campaign, there's a significant risk that our relationship of trust and confidence with that council member can be materially limited. And that is a conflict that we are legally and ethically required to avoid. And I would just submit and request that you please not direct us to do something that we believe would violate our ethical obligation. The auditor has asserted that we don't have a conflict of interest, but we believe that we do. And if you don't have confidence in your city attorney's ability to make that determination, then frankly, you probably have larger problems and should determine, rather than ordering the city attorney to do something that the city attorney believes creates an ethical conflict, at that point in time, you should really look at if you have the right city attorney. Because even if you direct your city attorney to do that, your city attorney still has an ethical obligation not to violate that representation. We did try to respond to the auditor just as soon as this matter was filed. It was within a very few days of when the matter was filed. We have offered names of attorneys who we believe are eminently qualified in these matters, and we have offered to help, which is not the normal practice and is not the normal budgetary practice, but we've offered to help fund outside counsel on this matter. So I would be very happy to answer any questions, but that is the situation as we see it. Thank you.
And I'd just like to point out that there is no representation of the mayor in this interest. And so the conflict, I think that what we're in danger of doing here is having the city attorney's office step out the second that any of you file litigation against the city. And so it leaves those of us in a regulatory position having to, at the 11th hour, go find legal representation. I just can't believe that this is what the city of Portland is going to decide is the way to proceed from here. There are regulatory functions all over the city. Any of you could get in some sort of conflict with the city at any time in your individual capacities. That's exactly what we're talking about here. And I find it amazing that we would not expect the city attorney's office to represent the interests of the city if we had a private action against the city.
So I'm a little astonished that the city attorney has stated that she feels it is illegal and unethical for her to do this, and yet you would like us to direct her to do it. Second of all, Tracy, I appreciate that position and I respect your ethics. On the substance of this particular appeal, is it not about whether a candidate can spend their own money on their campaign?
It is. That's my understanding, Commissioner.
And that has been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. So why we would invest any city money or any city time on something which has already been decided by the United States Supreme Court is baffling to me.
We do believe, Commissioner, that it is fairly straightforward. And for that reason, we tried to calibrate the funding that we offered to assist the auditor with to reflect that this matter should be able to be fairly summarily handled. The bigger issue, and I will be honest and say that quite likely if any of you individually sued the city for any reason, we would recommend outside counsel. It would not be appropriate for us to be representing the city against one of you individually, because again, we have a relationship of trust and confidence with each of you, and that would be negatively impacted. And we understand the auditor is of course correct that the campaign is not the same legal entity as the mayor. And we were looking at for that reason, the conflict of interest that we're specifying is the one that affects the material limitation rather than the rule 1.7A2 is not the rule that pertains to direct legal, the representation of one client that will be directly adverse to another client. That is rule 1.7A1, and the auditor's point is pertinent to that, but it is not pertinent to 1.7A2, which is the section of the professional rule that we're concerned with.
Thank you. I noticed Commissioner Ryan's hand went up and then Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz, Madam President. And also, I appreciate Madam Auditor being here to bring this forward. In the impact statement that you filed in relation to this proposed resolution, you name imprecise language of your office's regulations and overlapping regulatory structures between your office and open and accountable elections as two major challenges your office faces when it comes to compliance with and the enforcement of campaign finance issues. Wouldn't you agree that these significant issues can only be remedied by a more significant policy change than that which is being proposed at this time?
We do have some actions that we are preparing to take. One of them is that there's an issue in state law, which if you want to know the details of that, the current and former elections officers are in the meeting and can respond with some details. And we also are going to ask the Charter Review Commission to take up some of these issues so that they can we can keep the intent of the charter that was passed in charter and then create some opportunities for adjustments to be made by council as we go forward. But of course that'll take a long time and we don't even know if the Charter Review Commission would take that issue up.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Madam President. I was just wondering if you are looking for a motion on this matter.
Not just yet. We have, I think, one person signed up to testify.
Very good.
So let's move to public testimony, please, Keelan.
We have one person signed up, Janet Tessman.
Hello, Hello, the city auditor needs to use outside counsel for litigation having to do with campaign finance law. In 2017, Portland voters approved the auditor's very own proposal that included empowering the office with the ability to hire outside counsel. This measure won with a huge majority of over 86%. The auditor has said that it is too costly to use outside counsel in a matter of personal finance campaign finance. I understand that much has changed with the city revenue and budget since 2017. However, the enforcement of limits to personal campaign financing is too important of a corner to cut and must go to outside counsel. This matter is so important that cases regarding it could go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Please invest in the future of the integrity of campaign finance by asking the auditor to do her job and use outside counsel. Despite lots of precedents in the Oregon Supreme Court supporting limitations on personal financing of a campaign, and despite a total lack of federal precedent in striking down limits on loans to finance local elections, the auditor said she is waiting for cues from higher courts to tell if it's worth the time and money to enforce these limits on loans. This is totally backwards. Municipal and state governments are incubators for legislation. It is her duty to represent Portlanders and challenge higher up courts and systems of governments, not to wait for their permission. A donation to a campaign made from one's stores of wealth is one thing, even if that wealth is wrought from the theft of forests from indigenous peoples, but a loan has even more insidious implications. A loan means that instead of making multiple illegal contributions, Ted has made one big one that should cover any potential expense from the time of the donation to the election. What isn't spent of that $150,000, he can easily forgive himself for. Yet in the case that he wins, due to the auditor's emergency rules she wrote for herself, as an incumbent, Ted can continue to accept campaign donations after the election has already happened until the auditor chooses to certify the results. Everyone else will have to follow the regular law of Oregon defining an election cycle as lasting from the day after an election to the next. This means that would-be supporters of Ted could wait to see until after he wins to decide whether or not to invest further in the campaign. Supporters of other campaigns have taken great risks in investing for a campaign so that it may better reach potential voters. After the fact, there are no more voters to reach or good ideas to share. Rather, there is only political favor to garner. In those same emergency rules, the auditor has already signaled ahead of time to voters that she would only be writing letters of warning to lawbreakers during that grace period she created between Election Day and the certification of contest results. So supporters with even more to spare than the $500 campaign contribution limit could circle back to break the law after the election to donate more, confident that they will only receive a letter from the editor. It is the basic responsibility, or auditor, it is the basic responsibility of the auditor to represent, again, another huge majority of Portland voters, a full 87% of whom passed Portland campaign finance law. I would much rather my tax dollars go towards paying lawyers that will uphold the law, even if that means potentially accruing costs from being sued by a campaign later. And I know that there's this like, oh, it's not actually the mayor. No, it's the mayor. What kind of sore loser, timber baron air mayor during...
Thank you for your testimony. Your time is done.
Supposedly thirsty.
Jana, thank you for your testimony. Please mute, Jana. Thank you. Commissioner Ryan, with your hand up again.
No, I'm sorry, Madam President. I forgot to put it down.
Commissioner Fritz, can I respond to a couple of issues before we proceed?
I have a clarifying question. Did we not in the city budget allocate $500,000 to the auditor's office to be able to be used for unforeseen circumstances?
I have a fund for underspending, but I would like to go back and address the general counsel issue first.
I just have a point of order question. This is not a debate. You've made your presentation. We've had testimony. I think the council is ready to act. We're not debating.
I believe.
Is that accurate?
I believe I should have the opportunity to respond to things that are said. There's a lot of misinterpretations of things that are happening. And I believe there should be enough respect for the auditor's office that you hear me out.
I think that it's inappropriate to have this back and forwards. We don't do this with any other presentation. You made your case.
Commissioner Hardesty, I appreciate that you'd like to get to closure. I'd like to give the auditor a very brief statement, although, as Commissioner Hardesty says, we don't usually respond to community testimony when there are multiple things in it that we disagree with. But you're welcome
to
say.
I'm actually responding to something that Tracy Reeve said. I'm not responding to the public comment.
Well, again, you know, it's not a back and forth. If you'd like to make a quick statement, you may.
Yes. So there seems to be a reference from Tracy Reeve that the general counsel in my office can take and handle these cases. And there are 42 lawyers in the city attorney's office and 31 support professionals. I have one general counsel. And City Attorney Reeve knows full well that we have had years of conversation about the role of the general counsel in the auditor's office and the responsibility of the city attorney's office. So even back in 2016, we arrived at a policy about how outside counsel back then, I've subsequently gotten a general counsel in the auditor's office, when we would go for outside counsel and when we would rely on the city attorney's office. And litigation was never on the table for the auditor's office to foot the bill for, to handle on its own. It was an area of huge concern for Tracy Reeve that we were going to get a general counsel and then start suing people. And I said, no, I want a general counsel as an advice attorney. And that's what we have. And so when these administrative functions in the auditor's office are being carried out, they are in alignment with the city attorney's client, the city of Portland. And so there has never been an expectation that the general counsel in the auditor's office was going to do this kind of work. The general counsel does not advise on elections matters. That is the sole province of the city attorney's office. And we also specifically in our policy where we would use outside counsel said we would not use it for litigation. And so I would just like to correct the record or help her refresh her recollection on that, because it's in writing. I can provide the documentation to you. It's from December of 2016, and it has been the way we have proceeded through the charter amendments that gave my office independence and through the hiring of a general counsel. And finally, just before you vote, I'd like to say that I am not an attorney. I will not appear in court. And I do not have the funding. I don't have a litigation fund in my office. And so I think that maybe you all need to consider what some of your other options may be about how we're going to proceed with this.
Thank you for your statement. I believe we're probably ready to vote if Commissioner Hardesty is still here.
Yes, I am.
There you go.
Madam President,
this is a resolution, then it would require unanimity since there's just three of us here. So, Keelan, please call the roll.
Ryan. Commissioner Ryan.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for bringing this item before the council, Madam Auditor. Campaign finance reform is one of the most critical issues that our democracy faces at this point in time. And we have to keep working on it to make our elections more accessible for everyone. In my experience, the people are well served by the Open and Accountable Elections Program, and the Auditor's Office does an admirable job of implementing and carrying out the honest elections regulations passed by 87% of the voters. And let's remember, we are in the very early implementation phase of this best practice policy for campaign finance reform. In fact, just this week, I received a survey as someone that recently was a participant to give feedback on that program. Moreover, I agree with your assessment that the current situation between the significant regulatory hurdles placed on your office and the often overlapping regulations housed in OAE, there is a lot of work to be done. That is one reason I cannot support this. I firmly believe that a more fundamental restructuring of our city's campaign finance apparatus is needed, and that all parties involved must work together through every step of the policymaking process to clearly identify the problems and to find the solutions. I look forward to participating in that conversation and bringing my experiences from the recent campaign to the table, but at this time, I vote no.
Hardesty.
It is my understanding the city attorney had been working with the city auditor to assist them in as many lawsuits related to the city's new campaign finance law as possible. Upon being presented with this specific case at issue here, the city attorney made a determination that to represent the auditor in this case would be a violation of the city attorney's professional code of ethics. They suggested the city auditor hire outside legal counsel to help offset that cost of hiring outside legal counsel. The city attorney offered to give the city auditor $20,000 from their budget. I will also say that the auditor has a $500,000 reserve fund that could also be utilized. In response to this ongoing effort to help, the city auditor went behind the city attorney's back and filed this resolution, and then released the city attorney's confidential legal analysis to the press, all without discussing this issue with the city attorney. This resolution would set a dangerous precedent of the city council ordering the city attorney to do something that they view as unethical. Not only that, but the method with which this measure was brought before council is not in line with the values of collaborative governance that I, and I believe all my colleagues, view as essential to good policy making. Not only would this set a dangerous precedent, it would accomplish nothing. An attorney who is ordered to do something they view as a violation of their ethical standard is required to refuse to comply with that order, even if it means termination by their client. I want to be clear that I applaud our city attorney for not only striving to be as helpful as possible to all branches of city government, but also for being willing to take stands, be willing to stand by their convictions when faced with such a hostile action by someone else in city government. Additionally, I want to say that I find the method and attitude of the city auditor in this matter to be reprehensible. The auditor took an offer of financial assistance and instead decided to try and force professionals and colleagues to violate their code of ethics instead of having to spend any money out of her office's substantial reserves. This is not how elected officials should act, and I would suggest the city auditor take a good hard look at how this played out and consider ways in which she can work in a more collaborative fashion moving forward. I vote no.
Prince.
I agree with both of my colleagues. I'm frankly astonished that the auditor is insisting that the city attorney do something that they consider unethical. I've worked with the city attorney's office for 12 years, and sometimes over the course of those years, we have had disagreements between individual members of the council, and the city attorney's office has been able to fulfill their duties to each one of us, as well as to the city as a whole. And the ultimate responsibility of the city attorney's office is to the city as a whole and to the taxpayers. And so I'm frankly, as I say, dismayed that the offer of assistance was made with the city attorney's budget. The auditor does have a $500,000 reserve fund for just such expenses.
That's not correct. That's not correct. That is not what that fund is.
Thank you. Excuse me. You don't. This is the vote. We can have a conversation afterwards if you'd like. But we're part of that vote. So anyway, I can't support this either. And I think it is very unfortunate although each of us has our role, that we all need to be figuring out how we can work together for the good of the people of Portland. No. Keelan, does that conclude our agenda for the morning?
Yes, it does.
Thank you so much, everybody. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Madam President.